Members and audience, we'll call the meeting to order. I'm kind of waiting. Our fiscal analyst is printing a couple of documents for us, so we're going to proceed slowly and deliberately until she gets here. She could be kind of a helpful staff member to have. She always is, especially this morning. I did hear a phone ring at the table. Members, if you'd silence your phasers, that'd be great. I'm going to turn mine off because I'm not planning on taking any calls from anyone while I'm running the meeting. But please, if you at least just silence your ringers, that would be good. I do have a quorum, and we'll ask our CLA to note the roll as we come and go, because today there are two or three other committees meeting. I understand that, members, and members of the audience, too. If committee members get up and leave, that's because they have work to do in another room at the same time, so just be advised of that. Members, we have the minutes from our last meeting. We had a chance to look them over.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Schimansky.
I move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Representative Schimansky moves the minutes. Discussion to those? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. We've adopted the minutes. Appreciate that. Now, today we have two bills up, are we going to hear these, staff, one at a time or two at a time? One after the other? Okay. We will start with House File 210, Representative Kiffmeyer, on her picture ID, voter ID, picture identification required for voting. Representative Kiffmeyer, I'll let you say the title more succinctly than I have. Members, the portion of the bill that's before us today is the one that regards the Department of Public Safety, particularly Division of Vehicle Services, because they are going to be responsible, I believe, Representative Kiffmeyer, for actually issuing the photo ID the way these bills work. So to the members of the audience, we are going to ask that you, I know some of these have been contentious and spirited hearings. We have two testifiers on the list who will speak to the issues regarding issuing the photo ID and the costs pertaining to those. I'm not going to entertain much more public testimony beyond that. And members, if you could, the questions to the bill pertain to how DVS is going to pay for it, make it work, how it's going to be accommodated, and so on and so forth. And I'd appreciate your forbearance on that issue. And then when the bill leaves here, it will be going to Ways and Means. That would be the motion that the bill go to Ways and Means. Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would generally agree with you in terms of the province of this committee. Mm-hmm. I note that often we seem to stray. At the same time, Mr. Chair, given the importance of this issue, and I know I've heard on the House floor, as have you, was this issue brought up in committee? Was this idea question asked in committee? So I hope there'll be a little bit of latitude given the constitutional issue that's involved.
Certainly. Well, certainly to members of this committee, we've always enjoyed wide latitude. Thank you, Representative Morrow. Excuse me. And yes, when we get to the floor, when it comes to the function of DVS, we certainly will vet it this morning in this committee. Representative Kiffmeyer, we need someone to move your House File 210 to get it in front of us. Representative Vogel moves the House File 210. We recommend it pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be with you today, and thank you for giving your precious time of hearing this very important piece of legislation. Mr. Chairman, the general topic of the bill is to require voters to provide a photo ID before receiving a ballot, and other than for obviously those who receive an absentee ballot, their identity and provisions for that are secured through the absentee ballot provisions. Mr. Chairman, members, the sections that pertain to the Department of Public Safety in particular and DVS are sections 1 through 17. And Mr. Chairman, in regards to issues such as in section 1, the language there is that data on applicants for a Minnesota voter identification card under 17107 sub 3B, except that their data may be released to a government entity or a court. That just for carrying out its function. And Mr. Chairman and members, what we have attempted to do in a voter identification card, in addition to the Minnesota driver's license and the Minnesota identification card, is to keep those elements so that when the Department of Public Safety was administering this process, the ease and simplification of administering it, that there would be similarity between the other two. And so that is why many of these sections are in here, to just clarify that. Section 2 describes a voter identification card, and Section 3 forms of application. It just inserts a voter identification card to the list of others being used. Section 4 is listing other information about the fees, and in this area in particular, it clarifies on line 415 that the commissioner shall not collect any fee or surcharge for a voter identification card. That's an important component of this bill, Mr. Chairman, that those who need a voter identification card are able to receive one subsidized without additional charge.
Representative Kiffmeyer, forgive me, I had several things swirling about me when you started your presentation. In House File 210, the bill we have in front of us, do you have a page number where those sections are so that the chair could look them up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It starts right out on page 1, section 1, and I've been following the section numbers as we have gone through here describing. So section 1, again, had to do with the classifications. Mm-hmm. And on line 217 in particular is the new language. And just clarifies, again, similar to a driver's license or a Minnesota ID card, that only in a government entity or a court for purposes of carrying out its functions as it is able to do so with a driver's license or a Minnesota ID card. So just includes that.
Thank you. That helps helps the chair come up to speed on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 2, again, is a description of the voter identification card. Denotes citizenship, identity, residence, address, and may be used as identification and proof of residence for Election Day voter registration and for voting on Election Day, but for no other purpose. Section 3 is listing the voter identification card as one of the application types. Section, and again, Mr. Chairman, what we are doing here is bringing as many elements of the current driver's license or Minnesota identification card in the same sort of way to the voter identification card for ease of administration for the DVS, that they can have similarity, as many ways as they have similarity, it makes it better for them. Section 4, again, has a listing of the fees, which is repeat current language. Line 415, the commissioner shall not collect any fee or surcharge for a voter identification card. That's an important element, that those who come in and want a state-subsidized voter identification card do not pay any fee or surcharge to receive that card. Section 5, contents of license application, other information. And again, it's just listing an application for Minnesota ID card, enhanced identification card, instruction permit, driver's license, or so on. And it just includes on that language of Section 5, and in particular, if you continue on, there's just that slight change on line 418. Next section, Section 6, on line 6.3, an application for a voter identification card, including a renewal or a duplicate card or a new card required as a result of change of address. And it just describes the contents required. And again, these are also specific to the eligibility for voting. So it includes those elements that are normally and have been required under Minnesota Constitution and state law. Section 7 gives definitions and again includes the voter identification card on line 618 and 621. Section 8, again, the subdivision 3 application includes again the voter identification card, again, more of a technical addition. Section 9, equipment. This has to do with the agent may charge and retain a filing fee of $5 except for the application for a voter identification card for which no filing fee may be charged. Again, clarifying the language that this is a state-subsidized no charge to the applicant. On Section 10, the addition again of a voter identification card continues through Section 10 as a more of a technical inclusion. Section 11 takes voter identification cards requirement and more language. It also clarifies that the voter identification card must bear a distinguishing number assigned to the applicant, as we do similarly, by the way, to a driver's license or Minnesota ID card. But remember that they only receive this kind of voter identification card if they do not have a driver's license or do not have a Minnesota ID card. And again, that consistency where it receives that number consistent with the other types of cards. And again, many of the same elements of a driver's license or a Minnesota ID card are also included here for the voter identification card. We've also included the religious objection on lines 816, as is with the driver's license or the Minnesota ID card. The one thing is on line 823, each voter identification card must be plainly marked voter identification, not a driver's license, valid identification only for voting. And this is just to make sure a concern from DVS that this card not be mistakenly used for driving or other purposes allowed by law for a driver's license or an ID card. Section 12 has to do with expiration, which is similar to the driver's license, a Minnesota ID card, including the voter identification card in Section 12. In Section 13, improved security, this is including the voter identification card and those same elements of security that go with the driver's license, and also simplifies the administration so the same process can be used. Section 14 includes the same use of Social Security number as a part of the process, a key element for the driver's license and ID card as well on the voter identification card. Section 15 is another where we have the religious objection issue for the driver's license or Minnesota ID card. And that is carried over also into the voter identification card. Section 16, again, duplicate driver's license and duplicate voter identification card. Just clarifying again, maintaining those similar elements all the way through to duplicate. And Section 17 has to do with cancellation. Again, the same elements of a driver's license or Minnesota ID card brought forward. And Mr. Chairman, those are the 17 sections that pertain in particular to the Department of Public Safety. The other sections have to do with what the Elections Committee, GovOps and Elections Committee, heard and other committees as well in regards to the use of these voter identification cards. And Mr. Chairman, I do have a technical change that is a revisor's issue, but been recommended to me by staff. And Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I did not mark the page number on that.
Was that staff from this committee that recommended Representative Giffmeyer?
No. I went by quickly. There it is. I'd highlighted it in yellow, Mr. Chairman, but not put a sticky note. And it is on page 23, lines 17 through 22. And my oral amendment here is to delete lines 23, 17 through 23, 22. That was an amendment that did not, was a roll call amendment that did not pass and should not be in this engrossment, Mr. Chairman. And so just a technical error.
Okay, let's ask our staff, Mr. Burris. Do you have that, Mr. Burris? And how do we proceed in matters like this where an amendment did not pass but was still engrossed?
Mr. Chair and members, I do have that, and you could just vote that back out. That might not be necessary, but I'd have to look into it further on whether a vote is actually necessary to resolve an engrossment issue. So the clearest method might be to just go ahead and do the vote, but if you don't want to proceed that way, I could look into it further and get back to you.
Mr. Chairman, would you like some time for staff to do that? I'm perfectly willing to do that if you wish.
Well, just let me confer with staff here and see what we would like to do with that. If it's what was the last committee that this was in? It was
okay. Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Government operations, government, state government finances happen?
That's right.
And referred to here. Okay. I think what we're going to do is let's, when this is going to Ways and Means from here, let's note it. And we just got the note from the committee administrator of the State Gov Finance Committee, or State Gov Finance is the public safety, that indeed that's what happened. So I think we can take it in Ways and Means, or if this gets re-engrossed when it leaves here, they certainly should correct a revisor's error. Mr. Burris,
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, that it would be a revisor's correction. I just wanted to make sure that it was on the record and that we were clear as to what you were voting on, because it's a pretty big price tag.
It is. If that indeed is what happened, we'll ask the revisor. And I'm on that committee as well, so I can see this when it comes through after break. Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to necessarily dispute the ability to take this out. That's not my point. But if Representative Kiffmeyer could tell us a little bit more, it sounds like there was at least a discussion of this amendment and some confusion about whether it got in or not. Not asking Representative Kiffmeyer to contend for a position, but why was it argued that this $8.3 million was needed, and where did this occur?
Certainly. Representative Kiffmeyer, do you understand the question? Can you describe a little bit about that to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Morrow and members. This was not my amendment, so I don't feel that I should be defending somebody else's amendment back for it, except to state that this amendment in particular was defeated on a roll call vote.
So there is a recorded vote that did not prevail. Representative Morrow, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, although I did say in my question, I acknowledge that, Representative Kiffmeyer, it's not your amendment, but I'm trying to understand whether we should be bringing a motion to re-refer this back to the committee where that occurred, because there may be confusion within that committee as to whether this got on or not. I also don't understand what the $8.3 million was for, and I don't know whether the fiscal note that we've just been handed would be changed at all. So, Mr. Chair, I'm just not sure where this discussion should take place procedurally, and that's why I was hoping for a little bit of guidance of what the discussion was about.
Representative Kiffmeyer, can
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moore, members, I think I've been clear now on the third time that this is a roll call vote. I think that's about as clear as a committee can make it, that this was not voted to be in this engrossment, and it was very, very clear as to that action and to the wishes of that committee.
Well, Representative Morrow raises a question to which the chair will say, I'm perfectly comfortable passing it along with the discussion on the record to Ways and Means. And if it needs to be voted out there, or voted upon there is a better way to put that, we can certainly vote upon it there. We could take the vote here. The chair just chooses to pass that along. We do have a fiscal note we're going to speak to here in just a moment that Ms. Sewers put together for us. So thank you for calling it to our attention, Representative Kiffmeyer. And committee, the chair is going to just decide that we will pass this bill with that notation to the next committee. And if there is a recorded roll call vote, certainly the bill should be re-engrossed. I think, Mr. Burris, that is what probably will happen, if you'd like to comment to that.
Mr. Chair and members, I can work with the advisor's office and my colleagues in House Research on clarifying that for the next engrossment.
I'm also noticing, I think, in the the bill tracking from January 24th to now, it mentions that it went to GovOps. I remember hearing the bill there, passing it to State Gov Finance. I don't see State Gov Finance's name on there either, although it does clearly indicate that they passed it to us. Somebody passed it to us on February 14th. So if you want to put a little yellow tag by that, too, that some committee somewhere can claim responsibility for sending us this bill. We know who it was. I just want to see it in writing. That's what I want to see.
Mr. Chair, I'll note that as well and look into it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, as a clarification?
Yes.
The fiscal note does not include this money.
Does not. Okay. Well, members, does that include your testimony for now? Representative Kiffmeyer, are you ready to stand for questions before we call witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, out of respect to our witnesses, I know that it might be good. I can respond to questions after they've testified, if you wish.
All right. Well, members, if you'll hold your comments or questions for Representative Kiffmeyer, I do have two folks who would like to testify. Sherry Knuth from the League of Women Voters. If you'd like to come down to the testifier stand and make your comments. And Ms. Knuth, you've been here before. You know the drill. So thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am Public Policy Coordinator for League of Women Voters, Minnesota. Voting is a constitutional right protected by 6 constitutional amendments. The League of Women Voters opposes requiring a photo ID of registered voters at the polls because it is unnecessary, costly, and harmful. Unnecessary because the only thing that a voter photo ID can prevent is voter impersonation, and there is no evidence of voter impersonation in Minnesota. Costly because both state and local governments, and thus the taxpayers, must incur costs for providing photo IDs, educating voters and election personnel on the new photo ID requirement, and implementing a provisional ballot system, something that Minnesota has never had. And harmful because some voters do not have appropriate IDs and would face obstacles which are unsurmountable in some cases to obtaining IDs and getting to an election office to verify provisional ballots. A photo ID requirement would disenfranchise some of the very people who must work the hardest of all to vote. In my remarks today, I will focus on the requirement of obtaining a voter ID identification card from a driver's license facility. The fiscal note for HF 210 estimates that 144,000 Minnesota residents who are eligible to vote do not have a valid driver's license, permit, or ID card. This number includes a disproportionate number of elderly, disabled, and homeless, 10% of whom are veterans. It also includes a disproportionate number of younger voters, because they tend to move more often and frequently do not have a photo ID bearing their current address. Mr. Chair, I was going to comment on both bills right now rather than coming up again on HF 89.
Certainly.
Okay. Under HF 89, the language of the bill states that a state-subsidized voter identification card may only be applied at a driver's license facility operated by the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services. According to the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, there are only 14 locations in the state that meet that description. Thus, under HF 89, there are only 14 locations in a state where a voter can get a photo ID card for voting purposes. Under HF 210, there would be 139 locations in the state where a voter can obtain a voter identification card. This means that many rural residents will have lengthy round trips to a driver's and vehicle services agent or station. The frail elderly, disabled citizens, and low-income citizens will have particular difficulty in obtaining transportation to one of those locations, whether because of distance, lack of transportation, cost, or physical limitations. Reviewing the hours of driver and vehicle service locations that issue a first-time ID card, I found that only 17 of those 139 locations have Saturday hours. A few have evening hours, one evening per week. The vast majority of the 139 locations have only daytime hours. This means that a person seeking a voter ID or assisting an elderly or disabled person who needs an ID would have to take off work to go to that driver and vehicle service location. Courts that have reviewed photo ID laws have struck down those laws if states have not taken adequate steps to ensure that an acceptable photo ID is readily accessible to all voters and not unduly burdensome to obtain. Courts assess the time, transportation, and advance planning that are required to obtain an ID prior to an election. In Georgia, for instance, the first federal court to examine Georgia's photo ID law struck it down, in part because it found that many potential voters would find it difficult to travel to driver services centers to obtain an ID. The court noted that driver services centers were spaced widely apart and primarily were in rural areas where mass transit was not available. Although the state provided for one mobile ID center capable of issuing IDs, the court found it unrealistic to expect that only one mobile unit, which was not wheelchair accessible, would be able to service all counties to provide photo IDs. 2 months ago, the Brennan Center for Justice issued a report on the cost of voter ID laws as a result of court decisions. The report stated, to expand access to voter IDs, many states will have to expand the number of DMV offices or establish, outfit, and staff additional offices where voter IDs may be obtained. Incur the cost of keeping those offices open in the evenings or weekends, create mobile ID issuing centers that can traverse the state and issue IDs to those who have limited mobility or who do not have access to an existing ID issuing center, and assist those who would need help in understanding the law's new requirements. Each of these measures will involve significant expense. Another concern involves documents. Once at a driver and vehicle services office, a citizen must provide appropriate documents to obtain a voter identification card. Under the language of both HF 89 and HF 210, this applies even for renewal of a voter identification card. A copy of a birth certificate, which would establish citizenship and age, costs $26 in Minnesota. If a citizen's full name is different than the name on the birth certificate, a situation more likely to affect women, the citizen must also provide legal proof of her name change, such as a marriage license or divorce decree. A copy of a marriage license in Minnesota costs $9. Moreover, citizens may have to obtain birth certificates or marriage licenses from other states, thereby creating delays in obtaining a voter ID. A citizen may also have difficulty obtaining a birth certificate. In Indiana, after a photo ID law was implemented, election officials noted that some citizens faced a catch-22. They needed a birth certificate to obtain a photo ID, but they needed a photo ID to obtain a birth certificate. In Minnesota, we have an especially proud tradition of fair, open, and clean elections. Photo IDs are not required to protect the integrity of our elections because voter impersonation is non-existent in our state. HF 210 and HF 89 would take Minnesota several steps backwards by creating unnecessary obstacles for honest citizens to vote. League of Women Voters Minnesota urges you to vote against these bills. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Ms. Knuth, thank you. Thank you for testimony on both House Bill 89 and House Bill 210. Mr. Greg O'Connor is the next testifier that's listed here. Mr. O'Connor, the folks listening at home and for the clerk, would you state your name and organization you're with and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Greg O'Connor, and for the record, I have been a small business owner for the last 42 years. And more recently, the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Republican Liberty Caucus. When we're talking about voting, I think it's important to remember that the right to vote and the casting and counting of our vote represents the only voice we citizens have, the ultimate power, if you will, to select those who will make the decisions that directly impact the direction of our government and the role that government will play in our lives and businesses. What we see being done here in House File 210 is to take additional, reasonable, common sense steps, making our voting system as foolproof as possible, assuring that each citizen vote counts and that that vote is only cast by a citizen. Protecting the integrity of that system is one of the highest responsibilities of government. The suggestion that there might be some comparatively small additional cost, to my way of thinking, is a non-starter as an argument. In conclusion, a couple of reflections from our founding fathers come to mind. James Madison, in his 51st Federalist paper, talked about, quote, if men were angels. But maybe more to the point, Thomas Jefferson told us, quote, in questions of power, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution, end quote. If we substitute House File 210 for the word Constitution in this case, I think we have it. I urge unanimous support of House File 210. And just one additional comment, if I could, Mr. Chairman, to Ms. Newth and her comments and concerns about those disenfranchised. I wholeheartedly would be concerned about that as well, and would suggest that this is a perfect opportunity for organizations like the Republican Liberty Caucus and the League of Women Voters to join together to make sure that the necessary education and transportation for all of those individuals identified be assured so they can get their photo ID. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Questions for the testifier? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this bill, because we're just going to be looking at the cost, I think, today, of course, the question always comes to mind in bill after bill, in committee after committee, the high cost of not trusting one another. The bill and your testimony, I think there's a premise there that there's evidence that we can't trust one another on the integrity of our election system. And I wonder if you bring some body of research forward when you bring your concern that this is based on.
Mr. O'Connor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I have heard in earlier testimony that there were quite a number of voter identification cards that were mailed out that were returned as non-deliverable. In the present system, with the ability of one person to vouch for another as being a registered legal citizen, it just opens up that opportunity. We're all human, and we're all frail in that sense. And I think because of the importance of our vote, as I stated, because it elects the people that represent us in our government and affect our lives and businesses, I think we need to take every common sense step to make sure that the integrity of that system is without question.
Mr. Representative, follow-up?
In preparation for today, was reading through some of the recommendations from a survey that was done, in large part based on information from Minnesota County attorneys. And the one thing has already been cited, that we have never had one case of conviction for voter impersonation in Minnesota. But the other one was 9/10,000 of 1% of all 2008 voters were convicted of fraud, and all of the convictions were due to felons voting. And they cite a bill that was overwhelmingly passed by the Minnesota legislature in 2009. Because you would assume if that's the major issue, informing people who are convicted and sentenced that they cannot vote would be fairly important to us. In this bill, the requirement passed by an overwhelming majority to inform felons in both the House and the Senate, but the governor vetoed the bill to inform felons. The one problem that is identified in this state, the governor vetoed the bill for three reasons: that Minnesota already has enough mandates, that the Department of Corrections already has a process in place that informs offenders about their voting rights prior to being released from prison, and that citizens should be responsible for being informed about their own situations and rights. As I listened to your testimony, it did seem to be big on education. And yet, in this state, the one problem that we've actually convicted 9/10 of 1% of voters was this issue, which we have not yet fixed. Does that seem like a reasonable bill to go back to?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, maybe I could call on Mr. McGrath, who has done extensive research and I think could better address that question.
Well, since Representative Hausman did ask for supporting documentation, if Mr. McGrath can speak to that in an attempt to answer the question or the comment, yes, let's have Mr. McGrath come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan McGrath. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Majority. Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, to your initial question about documentation of problems in our election system, you'd mentioned that there hasn't been a conviction for voter impersonation in the state, and to my knowledge, that's true. But voter impersonation isn't really the right term to use. With election day registration and vouching, identities can be made up out of thin air. I can go into a polling place and have someone vouch that I'm Mickey Mouse, and now my voter registration goes through as Mickey Mouse. The person doesn't exist. So that's not voter impersonation so much as voter invention. The way that this would be detected would be with the return of what's called a postal verification card. These are mailed out to every new voter registration, every new voter registrant after they register. Following the 2008 election, 38,000 of those postcards came back as undeliverable, and 23,000 were from election day registrations, which accounts for about 5% of all election day registrations were unverifiable. To the felon question, there was significantly more felons that illegally participated in the 2008 election than is indicated by prosecutions, because the prosecutors were unable to prove intent. That doesn't mean that ineligible voters, thousands of them, didn't influence the process, just simply that they weren't prosecutable because of an inability to prove intention to break the law. As to Governor Plenty's veto, Governor Plenty is no longer here, and Greg isn't Governor Plenty, and nor am I.
Mr. McGrath, the those voter cards that have been referred to a couple times, how often after the election are they mailed out?
Mr. Chair, pretty much immediately after the data is entered, those postcards begin to get mailed out after every election.
Okay. Representative Hausman, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that return of voter registration applications would seem to suggest that what we heard from Ms. Knuth earlier is probably true. Many of them are students who change addresses frequently, and those who are homeless, of which we have an ever-growing number of people who wouldn't have an address. Wouldn't that seem to suggest those are the people we're disenfranchising?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, that is certainly the case under some circumstances. But we've actually, our organization, Minnesota Majority, has driven around to the addresses that some people provided on their voter registration applications that resulted in a return postal verification card, and found non-existent addresses in many cases, swamps, forests, freeway overpasses. They were clearly, the property that was listed on the voter registration was not residential, warehouses, other industrial facilities in some cases. The Secretary of State's office is now required to compile a report after the elections of referred postal verification card returns, or postal verification card returns that have been referred to county attorneys for criminal investigation. After the last election, they issued the first such report that was mandated by legislation passed last session, and they have referred 399 such names for investigation because they cannot determine the reason that the postcard came back, that there was a valid reason for it.
Follow up.
And just a final, Mr. Chair, I mean, because really the issue before us is, should we impose a cost? That's, is there a problem identifiable and of such concern that we should, as a legislature, impose a cost on the process of voting? Will we be hearing from the Secretary of State's office as to the problems?
Representative Hausman, in this committee, no, they have not asked to testify. We have not asked them to testify. DVS is available for questions about how this would be implemented and verifying costs and so on, if you wish to have that discussion. But no, I've not asked Secretary of State to come to the committee, nor have they asked to come to this committee.
So, Mr. Chair, will DVS or will the departments that we are concerned about, will they be testifying to their understanding of the cost?
Representative Hausman, if we request, I have asked the department. They said no, they have not asked to testify. But if we have questions about how they will implement it or what they think the costs are, they could speak to that. And I think that's where they'll limit their comments. After this is a policy question that is being decided by the elected officials in this place, and staff has been marvelous about working with the policies that the legislature has moved to them, regardless of what those policies are. So I don't think they feel they want to testify as much to the policy as to the mechanics of how they'll make it work. So they are available for questions if you wish. Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to try to follow your process. I thought
certainly
you wanted to have the two testifiers who signed up testify. Mm-hmm. What were you hoping to, and then I obviously ask if anyone else wanted to testify. Sure. I think you had mentioned, what was your next step? I know we have a fiscal note to walk through and the like. I've got a lot of questions about this, but I don't know when to ask them, so I thought I'd ask you what your preference is.
Well, after we have questions for the testifiers, and Mr. McGrath, you probably stand down now. Mr. McGrath specifically had information Representative Hausman
yes.
asked for, which is why I allowed
mm-hmm.
him to come up.
Thank you.
We will have questions for the author of the bill, and I'm going to ask staff to walk through the fiscal note before we do that, or at some point in that process. So that's where we're at with that. Follow-up?
I do have a series of questions on the issue that Mr. McGrath brought up. I think mm-hmm. Representative Kiffmeyer would be the one to answer them. So maybe this is the time to ask those questions since they were on that topic, or do you want to go turn to the fiscal note first?
We're done with the testifiers that have signed up to testify, so Representative Morrow, please, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm following up a little bit from Representative Hausman's questions because I'm trying to understand how this would work with many of my constituents who are college students. So if you could just walk me through, if a student is living on campus, none of them have a driver's license that have, for example, 800 West College Avenue on them. Maybe there are a couple, but I doubt it. How would they vote?
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Morrow and members. In the bill, House File 210, a student generally has a driver's license, almost always, whether it's from Minnesota or another state. They are usually proud holders of their driver's license. And if need be, they can get a state-subsidized voting identification card and apply for that like anybody else. But the presumption is most of them would. In my bill, it actually, I think, provides the approach that identity, who you are, and where you live are two separate issues. And many times our driver's license, Minnesota ID card, or the voter identification card, or the tribal ID card, would have both who you are and where you live. And that is the large majority. And by the way, Minnesota law currently requires that within 30 days of a change of address that you update any one of those cards. That's a current requirement, nothing new there. And so a student in particular that may be from Wisconsin, they could use their Wisconsin driver's license for their identity. Their residence can be, it might have a, they might have decided to change and claim residency here in Minnesota and have a Minnesota driver's license. Some of them take that approach as well. They're able to do that. But no matter which, whether it's a Wisconsin or Minnesota driver's license, they're able to use that. As far as their residency is concerned, the student housing list is able to be used. A fee statement that has their current residency is able to be used, and their Minnesota driver's license with their current address or Minnesota ID card or the voter identification card. Remembering that in current law right now, you find students that are leaving and not voting because with all the possibilities that they have right now, there can be confusion. And I hear this from students, that they are in a situation of going to vote and they didn't know that the utility bill had to have their name on it. That isn't always the case. So there have always been issues with students in particular. And again, with the heavy public education campaign that I would assume would also be done in college campuses, their understanding of both proof of identity, whether it's Minnesota, another state, driver's license will work. And then their residency requirement, which could be on the same card they're using for identity, or there's other, but because it's a little simpler, more streamlined option, I think it will be clearer for students and will actually enfranchise more of them because of that clarity. But if that helps explain under this bill that how that would work.
Representative Morrow, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Representative Kipmar. So I want to make sure I understand. So I'm going to try to make it more specific. A student from Wisconsin lives on campus at Gustavus. Gustavus provides that list that you mentioned of all the students who live on campus, and they provide it to, I believe it's the auditor, in Nicollet County. They've been doing that in previous elections. Would that student be able to go down on election day and vote with the Wisconsin picture ID, provided that the list is down there from Gustavus? Is that all that's required under your bill?
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Morrow. That is one way, also the fee statement. But for those who live on campus, the most frequent, the one that's been done for a while. Matter of fact, my bill also allows for that list to be sent electronically to the Secretary of State, because sometimes that administratively can make it a lot easier. But that is probably one of the most common ones. One of the problems right now is that the ability to use that identity tool, I think we can trust Wisconsin to prove the identity of their Wisconsin students on that identity issue alone, and then the student housing list.
Representative
Morrow, yes, that would accomplish it in that case.
I'm sorry, Representative Kipmeyer, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. So I would, just to be clear, because I'm going to move for off-campus students in a moment, but for on-campus students, the situation wouldn't change under your bill.
Representative Kipmeyer?
There would be no new requirement for an on-campus student under the situation I just described. They have a photo ID, they have a driver's license, say, from Wisconsin, and Gustavus sends the certified list to the auditor. For those students who live on campus at Gustavus, the situation wouldn't change if your bill became law.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, we've actually enhanced it because previously it had to be a Minnesota ID, and now we have expanded that they can use an identification from a different state.
As long as they can prove their residency.
The residency of Minnesota, and again, residency required by Minnesota law is those 20 days, which in general, for a November election, they generally qualify and they're on a student housing list. In that particular case, yes.
Well, thank you.
Follow up, President.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Kiffmeyer, thank you for clearing that point up, because I had heard that even the on-campus students were going to be required to go get a new ID card, and that's not what I'm hearing. But I want to turn to the off-campus students now. So what would an off-campus student need to do, because they don't have a certified list sent by the college, because the college doesn't tell them where all the off-campus students are living? What does an off-campus college student have to do?
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Morrow, and members of the committee. An off-campus student would have the same identity requirements as any other Minnesota voter, any other student. That same identity requirement and allowance would be there as well. But for their residency, that is where a fee statement sent to that address where they are residing in, or having a state-subsidized ID card could be used. And again, if they have a Wisconsin driver's license, then they would qualify for a Minnesota voter identification card because it is specific to Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kipmeyer, I need to step back a second. The on-campus student wouldn't need to get a new Minnesota driver's license or state ID or voter ID. They could use their Wisconsin driver's license alone to vote.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, no. The only thing they use the other state's license for would be only for identity.
Okay, well, I'll go back to section 11.
In other words, the concept, Mr. Chairman,
thank you,
is that you are the same person you were, yeah, and it's an identity question. Okay. So it proves your identity.
I'll go back and read. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I apologize.
That's right.
I'll go back and read the relevant section on my question on the on-campus. I'm imagining I rent out a house. I do. I'm not even imagining it. I actually really do rent out a house.
Representative Morrow, would you give us the page number you're about to read so we can follow along?
I'm not about to read, sir. I am going to go back to that section and read it quietly to see if I misunderstood it. But
okay.
I'm now on the off-campus student, and I rent to three students. So those three students don't have a certified list because I'm not eligible to give one. If I understand your bill correctly, I can't vouch for them. I can't walk across the street and say, these are my three tenants in the house right across from the polling place. My wife and I keep the utility bills in our name because we try to help them out. We don't want them to have to go down and pay the city of St. Peter deposit in order to turn on the gas and electricity. And we also like to have the utilities on during the summer. They don't get fee statements with their rental address on them. Typically, if I understand correctly, Gustavus, their fee statements are sent to their home address. So I'm not sure how an off-campus student would vote unless they were to go to the courthouse, and I'm going to come to that point next, and go get a new ID card. Do I have that right?
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Morrow, an off-campus student would have the requirement to prove their identity, but they also need to prove their residence. So if they are off-campus, they would be in a situation that that may include getting a voter identification card or being a resident of Minnesota, having a Minnesota driver's license card. Most of the time, students do want to drive, or a Minnesota ID card if they're not going to use it for driving. And that would include their residence then.
Representative Morrow, can I interject
yes,
a relevant
sir.
Question? Representative Kiffmeyer, if the off-student campus lives in another precinct, would they have to register in that precinct? They couldn't come on campus and vote in the campus precinct, if I'm understanding correctly.
Mr. Chairman, they must register to vote in their precinct of residence.
All right.
That is for everybody in Minnesota, no exception made there for students either.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Morrow,
thank you
for the indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm by no means arguing students shouldn't register to vote. Obviously, they should. I'm thinking of, for example, my tenants. When one of them, for example, they get a cable bill, they do register that. They do have one of the tenants' names on that utility bill. And I know in the past what's happened is that the three or four of them would walk across the street. The one of them say, these are my roommates, but I'm the only one who gets a utility bill in my name, and was able to vouch for the other three. What it sounds like now is that all at least three, if not four of them, would need to go get a new ID card to vote. In the situation we've been talking about, off campus, no fee statement, no certified list. They can't vouch for each other, if I understand your bill correctly, so now they would have to go down and get a government-issued ID card from Minnesota, correct?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, in that specific instance you're talking about, that student has options. If they are, they can vote an absentee ballot from their home, first of all. Mm-hmm. There's no requirement that mandates them to vote at their college precinct. That is a choice. Mm-hmm. The only people that have a choice, by the way. If you are employed and you work somewhere else down here in the cities, you still must vote back in your precinct of residence. And there are many, many workers who deal with the issue of getting off work, going to work, doing those things, and students have the same voting hours as 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. as any other citizen of Minnesota does as well. In particular, for these students in this case, they have a choice. They can vote an absentee ballot at home, either through the mail, or they can go back home. There are times in between, there's about 30 days, that they can do an in-person absentee ballot at their county courthouse as well. If they choose to vote at the college campus in that situation, then they have choices to make, and that requires some responsibility on their part. If they are on campus, there's a little different situation because of the student housing list. And if they are off campus, then yes, they have a little bit greater variety as far as proving identification, both to Minnesota from another state as far as proving their identification. And then for proving of their residency, yes, either a state-subsidized voter identification card or deciding to have a Minnesota driver's license or Minnesota ID card. And many of these students have a lot of responsibilities in regards to coming to college. These are very smart kids that are coming to college, but I think a simpler structure will enable us to enfranchise more of these students because of a simpler structure.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Kiffmeyer, first, and I certainly understand the absentee ballot situation, and certainly students can, and they do vote absentee already. although some students choose to vote locally in part because there are not only federal and state elections, but there are local elections. And they wish to have a voice in local elections. They wish to have a voice when it comes to ordinances, for example, that might directly affect them. And I know you understand that as well, that folks may want to have a local participation in voting. But what I guess what I'm trying to clarify here is there was an offhand reference to people pretending to be Mickey Mouse, or someone could put down Mickey Mouse, and I think that's I question that example. I think that's an insulting example in this context. No one's putting down Mickey Mouse and then being allowed to vote. But I'll put that aside. But do we have any evidence that college students are doing this? That college students are pretending to be somebody else or pretending to be someone that they're not? I just wonder why we're targeting it. We're not targeting. Why one segment of our population, I would argue, be negatively affected. We could discuss that without, I don't know more about whether they're actually violating our election laws right now. Maybe you have insights I don't, so I'm asking you to share them. Because I don't see the college students in my area doing this, but maybe you have evidence.
Representative Kipmeyer, when you do, I'd like to add a little further expound on the question. Could you tell us a little brief history about how college students got the exemption that the rest of us don't enjoy? For instance, I spent a lot of my time in St. Paul, and I'd love to come down here and vote in some city elections, but alas, this is not the precinct in which I reside, even though I spend a great deal of time here. Perhaps you could help us understand how college campuses came to be kind of different than the rest of us as you answer Representative Morrow's question. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, in fact, this is a requirement placed upon all voters, not just students. This is something that is, and I assure you that everybody, for the large part, has different issues to deal with in voting in an election, whether they're driving long ways to work and then going back home and arranging, bringing in three small children with a mother with three small children coming in to vote. I think all of us as Minnesotans that the price of freedom is not free. And so for those of us, the citizen involvement and the effort that we make, just as a general principle here, that the effort of voting is certainly something well worth that effort and for our students as well. But I do think that there is no particular burden in regards to the students being targeted by means, and I find that offensive that you would even say something as while we're doing that. And any example being used, such as John Smith or Joe Smith, you might choose a better name, but that's a little difficult too because there might be an actual John Smith or Joe Smith, and we don't want to impugn their character, so I think the testifier was just using an example name. But in reality, in this situation, you know, my question is to you in regards to voter impersonation. Mm-hmm. Without a photo ID, how do you know? I mean, you have a stranger to a stranger. You are renting your property to somebody. Mm-hmm. I think you usually go through some background checks or you go through some verification of their previous history as a renter. Any good landlord would do those things and do those checks. So I think that that is well established. You open up a bank account. You go to the grocery store to cash a check. I mean, in our society, a stranger-to-stranger interaction generally in those areas does require some of that. And so I think in this particular case, proof of who you are and where you live, as has been upheld by the courts, is a reasonable requirement, and that voting in itself is a constitutional right but a qualified right. There is an age. It is restricted to citizenship, those who are citizens, restriction to in your precinct. So there are various of those things, and also on our voter registration lists, we do have name and address. And by the way, prior to Election Day, there is verification of those eligibility requirements. So if you register to vote before Election Day, verification of any challenge status, of your address, of your name as sent out by a postal verification card is done. All of those verifications are already being done. The issue is that on Election Day, without those verifications, which is in my bill, without those verifications, a ballot is cast, never to be able to be removed, and yet later on, We have people who have voted when they were not entitled to vote because those verifications were not done before the casting of a ballot, and those ballots were then counted, thus disenfranchising other people who cast legitimate ballots. I mean, there is that disenfranchisement of a vote when somebody who was not supposed to cast a ballot did. You're disenfranchising someone else's legitimate ballot. It does go in regards to that. We do have proof of that. But in regards to impersonation, since you have stranger to stranger, people who do not know each other, that you do not have that verification on election day. And so my question to you is, how do you know? And this has nothing to do with what your age is at all. Just simply has to do with a simple voter requirement. When you come to vote, as we do before election day, we verify who you are, where you live. Do the same thing on election day before a ballot is cast.
Follow-up, Representative?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd be willing to vouch for you. So you could vote in St. Paul if that's what you chose. You just can't vote two different places. So the process, I think, is not limited to college students. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think you
are wrong.
If you were to change your residency to St. Paul, but
there you go.
That's the key. I understand the stranger to stranger part, although, again, I think I'm going to pick up on Representative Hausman's point and the idea that, but somebody came in and said, this person is who they say they are and they live here. And so there is some proof. We might dispute whether that proof is sufficient or not, and we may have different points of view. I could walk across the street with my renters and say, they are renting from the house. Here's the lease. Unfortunately, the lease doesn't count as proof under this bill. But, Representative Beard, I'm going to just turn then just more to a comment then just to close off this section because I know we have other folks. It's about the fiscal note, and we're going to go through the fiscal note. I'm concerned there are blanks in the bill. We're going to come to the blanks in the bill. But I'm imagining the hundreds of Gustavus students who live off campus. Mr. Chair, if the hundreds of Gustavus students who live off campus all need to go to the county auditor now to have this done, I understand the card's free, but I'm going to ask Ms. Zewers, not Representative Kiffmeyer, but Ms. Zewers, when we go through the fiscal note to explain where's the county cost covered for servicing what would be, I believe, there are hundreds of students who live off campus, just in my campus alone.
And I'm certain every campus, and those would be very relevant questions. Members, before we do, though, I'm going to go back to page 23. So we're going to take a step aside here for just a moment, talk about this section from 2317 to 2322. My original inclination was to fix this in Ways and Means. Mr. Burris did give me, going to give me another word in my ear here, just a moment. To adopt this here. Do we have copies of this for everyone? Will you make them? Distribute them, please. Okay. Members, we're going to fix. There actually was an error. Representative Morrow, you raised an excellent point about the blanks on line 2314 and 15.
And also, but on 25 and 6. Or, sorry, just 5 as well.
Line 5, yes. You're going to get an amendment distributed to you, and what I'm going to do is back off of this motion at the moment. Representative Szymanski had some comments and questions, and then after Representative Szymanski's done, then we'll come back to this, because I want you to actually see it for a few moments before we act on it. The reason is, when we moved this on the House floor, it was explained to me, it's as if the entire body adopted the bill with the wrong language and the blanks in it, when indeed the last committee, State Government Finance, actually passed this amendment. So what we will do then is we will take the action and attempt to pass this language here, which will put it in the form that State Government Finance actually intended when it left their committee. But because it actually went through a vote on the floor when it was moved from committee to committee, it's as if the entire House actually endorsed the language that's in the bill now. You understand what I'm trying to say? Everybody clear on that? So if you want to contemplate that amendment, I'll back off of making that motion at the moment. We'll go to Representative Szymanski for some more questions and comments, and after Representative Szymanski's done it, it'd be my intent that we try to put the bill in the shape that actually left State Gov Finance. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Chairman Beard. Representative Kiffmeyer, what is the duration of a voter ID card? In other words, is there an expiration date on those cards?
Representative Kipmeyer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Szymanski, it is the same as a driver's license or a Minnesota ID card, which is generally 4 years.
Representative Szymanski?
Chairman, and is the on reapplication after 4 years after it expires, is there will they require to prove identity once more at that point, or will they just be granted a renewal of that card?
Representative Kipmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Szymanski, having read this language in the morning, I do not see that upon renewal there is that requirement again. It is similar to the driver's license and the Minnesota ID card, that when you make a renewal, that the same requirements are there, so you would not have to go through that process once again.
Representative Kiffmeyer, likewise, if there's a change of address, then there would also not be an additional proof of identification upon change of address.
Representative Kipmeyer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Szymanski, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted
follow
to,
up.
You know, assure myself that for those folks that on the initial application, if they needed to get a birth certificate or a marriage certificate document, that they would not to have to reacquire those documents for a renewal.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I also, in light of this, I wanted to be sure also to clarify that you cannot vote in two places. You are not given that choice, only at your place of residence. It is only students that are given this choice situation. And only when they're in a college campus, by the way, not in any other situation, only in a educational situation. So I just in case, I just wanted to make sure that we clarified for the record, unless you change your residency, if you're other than a student, only if you change your actual residency, and then then you're changing your residency and you vote where you have your residency. So I just wanted to make sure that we clarified that. Students actually have way more options than anybody else does.
Representative Kipmeyer, that's why I asked that follow-on questioner side-by-side with Representative Morrow's, because students, as I understand, are kind of in a transitional phase of life with being able to vote at age 18, but oftentimes maybe they're at home, maybe not. They're starting to is that why we've created, in your opinion, this sort of a subset of election law for college students?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I've done is I've preserved the current situation. I've not changed that law, so that students are in that situation, having that choice. But I would like to mention a very particular situation where that option has gotten some students in trouble, convictions of double voting. And many times, and I shouldn't say many times, but in these few instances of actual convictions, they have voted an absentee ballot and then also voted at a campus polling place. And in one particular situation, we have a court case going forward right now of a young lady who voted in the enthusiasm of the campus of going to vote and that whole situation and misunderstanding that it is a choice of one or the other, not both. We have a court situation going on, and you feel really bad for these students that are in that, but sometimes this choice actually leads to issues for them that they sometimes unwittingly do, although you would think that our students would understand one vote per person on an election day. But nonetheless, that choice has led to some convictions, which are sad to say have happened.
Okay. Before we go to Representative Champion, let's take up the matter of the A35 amendment. Members, do we all have it so we see what we're working with here? Representative Kipmeyer, do you see the A35 amendment? Do you have that in front of you?
Yes, I do. I have it in front of me, Mr. Chairman.
Is this what was passed in state government finance?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is what was passed.
Now, if I could have a member move the A35 amendment, that would be a good thing. Representative Vogel, since you moved the bill, Representative Vogel moves the A35 amendment, and further discussion to that amendment to put the bill as it was actually intended to be in front of us, members. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this question was asked somewhere else, but if we are doing it for the record now,
sure.
Do we need to ask the Secretary of State's office to come forward to determine we're taking it from one account in that office
I
and transferring it to this use? Do we need to understand?
Is there someone from the Secretary of State's office here that
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Frazier, Representative, or Kipmeyer. Oh, yeah, there's Ms. Frazier over here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to have the Secretary of State come and address the issue, but we are not taking any money from within the Secretary of State office. This is a Help America Vote Act account, which is a separate special revenue account or a dedicated fund account.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for fiscal years 12 and 13. Monies that may be needed and already appropriated to the Secretary of State from this account are uninterrupted.
And we're going to do this explanation, Ms. Frazier, bearing in mind that this is the Transportation Finance Committee, and we're concerned primarily about DVS, but I think Representative Hausman raises a question that we should at least have an understanding of what state government finance did when they attempted to pass this amendment. We're going to pass it again here in just a moment, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And this bill appropriates $880,000 from the Help America Vote Act account to our office exclusively for implementing this bill. The Help America Vote Act money is money that was given to the state of Minnesota from the federal government. And at the end of this biennium, we estimate that there will be about approximately $2.5 million left in this account. We've heard from Congress that there will not be additional money appropriated, and in fact, the president has not included any additional funds in his budget. So this is the end of that appropriation. And we would expect to spend almost all of that money on continued maintenance of the statewide voter registration system, on implementing data matching that has been implemented in the past few years, and on for transportation, on continuing to pay a contract that we have with the Division of Vehicle Services to pay for data verification of registrants. If we are very concerned about money from that account being dedicated to implementation of this bill and not having sufficient funds to continue to maintain the system and do the data matching and meet other requirements.
Okay, and I assume that was very similar to your testimony in state government finance as well, Ms. Frazier?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, further questions for either before we repass this amendment, which apparently was passed once and forgotten in the shuffle? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor of the 835 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
The motion prevails. The 835 amendment is adopted. Thank you, members, for helping with the housekeeping. Mr. Burris, we hope that there'll be like a yellow sticky note attached to this one or something this time around. So. We can actually get it in the real bill.
Mr. Chair, we'll have long talks and make sure everyone is clear.
Outstanding. Now, we understand it is crunch time up at the revisor's office, and we've seen them do some yeoman's work. So hopefully if we're gone for about 7 days, they can catch their breath and get back on some of this stuff. But thank you, members, for a little housekeeping work there. Representative Champion, thank you for your patience. You're up, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I would like to turn your attention to Section 6, which is on page 6, and Subdivision 3B, where it talks about the application for voter identification card. And I noticed two things. One, on line 6.5, it says must, and then on line 6.7, it talks about a Social Security number, that is something that must be provided. And it made me think about the Privacy Act. Section 7 of the Privacy Act provides that it, and I quote, that it shall be unlawful for any federal, state, or local government agency to deny to any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law because of such individual's refusal to disclose his Social Security account number. So with that being true, can you please explain to me and the rest of the committee how you will reconcile this privacy notion with the language that's in your bill.
And Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, sorry, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Champion, in regards to this particular section, if you notice, current law says an applicant's Social Security number must not be displayed, encrypted, or encoded, and is that section on 210-2, is that the section where you are at, Representative Champion?
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, no, actually. If you look at page 6, section 6, specifically subdivision 3B,
oh, okay, Mr.
Chairman. And Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you.
And just so that we're clear again, because now that you have the right mm-hmm. page, if I might, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you look at 6.5, line 6.5, it uses the term must, which is a directive. Then if you look at line 6.7, it requires that the person applying for a voter identification card provide their Social Security number. If you look at line 6.7, and why that is a concern to me is because I looked at section 7 of the Privacy Act, and it specifically provides that, quote, it shall be unlawful for any federal, state, or local government agency to deny to any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law because of such individual's refusal to disclose his Social Security account number. And so I wanted to understand, and if you help us understand how the language of your bill reconciles or line up with the Privacy Act.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Champion. Representative Champion, as I stated before, this bill takes the same elements of the Minnesota driver's license, the Minnesota ID card, and now the voter identification card, and includes those same elements that are with those others. And if those others have been allowed by law, then we have taken those same elements and included them here. As a matter of fact, on Section 14, the use of the Social Security number must not be displayed, encrypted, or encoded on the driver's license, Minnesota ID card, or voter identification card are included in any way to store data on any one of those cards. Must not be used. And so it is a security issue, but it is currently common elements that are as part of the Minnesota driver's license, Minnesota ID card, that as I've said before, we have brought those things over and included them here as well.
Mr. Follow-up, Chair, with a follow-up?
Yep.
Isn't it true, Representative Kiffmeyer, that under your bill, they will be denied a voter ID card in the event that they do not provide a Social Security number? So we're talking about denying them a right to vote, because if they don't provide the Social Security number, then they can't vote because they don't have a card. Isn't that right?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, nobody would be denied the right to vote. They're given an option here to give information, and the federal law, the Help America Vote Act, actually allows through the federal law to collect the information, such as a driver's license, an ID card, or the Social Security number. And in Minnesota, we collect the last four digits of the Social Security number. Other states do collect the full Social Security number. So I'm relying upon federal law and Minnesota state law as far as what I've included here.
Representative Kiffmeyer, are these Social Security numbers checked? We only take the last four for our voting? Is that what you just said?
Mr. Chairman, and the last four digits are what is required. It is a minimum requirement of the Help America Vote Act, and it is the last four digits. But the Department of Vehicle Services had to go through quite a bit of programming
yes.
because they routinely collect all of the Social Security numbers, the entire number. And so to go down to the four digits, it required quite extensive programming on their part in a variety of ways to accommodate that. But that is what we do on currently when it is the voter registration application.
Just a comment, Representative and members, just to ruminate on. We heard testimony the other day on the E-Verify program that there have been instances where Social Security numbers have been purloined for illegitimate purposes, sometimes with up to 3,000 names assigned to the same Social Security number. I would hope that somewhere we would be able to cross-check, or is that not the purpose of your bill? And pardon me, Representative Champion, for getting ahead of you here. Perhaps Ms. McCormick can speak to that expertly. Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee, and thank you for coming and shedding some light on a few things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And the driver's license and identification card do require the entire Social Security number, and the purpose of that is for various reasons. One has to do with commercial driver's license regulation, and secondly, it has to do with the Federal Welfare Reform Act that was passed in the 90s. And by that act, DVS gets the Social Security number, and it is shared with specific agencies that we have a strict data privacy agreement with, and it's for the purpose of child support enforcement. And so the Department of Human Services, the Department of Revenue, the Internal Revenue Service, DNR, are the agencies that we share that information with, and only that information is shared with them in a secure file transfer that takes place every night. That law was passed, I think, in 2003, and the purpose of it was because without that, the state would have been penalized over $48 million on an annual basis because the federal law requires that. In terms of what we do at the Secretary of State's office, as Representative Kiffmeyer stated, we have a specific data privacy agreement with them, and that is just to verify the last four digits of the Social Security number.
Okay, thank you for that information. Representative Champion, if you have a follow-up, I've got a couple more people on the list here, and I would like to move on this.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just a couple follow-up. Mm-hmm. One is, it's my understanding that, so that we are making a clear distinction between the two, is that driver's license administrations are entitled to ask for Social Security cards, and that's different. Those Social Security numbers are different, and that any law that interferes with that would be considered null and void. I think because we're talking about a different exercise of one's right to vote, and the context by which we are talking about this is different. And so with that, is it possible that I can just ask the Secretary of State's office a couple questions as it pertains to how they believe that this particular bill and this specific language around Social Security numbers will interfere with their ability to do their work and potentially one's right to vote?
Well, Representative Champion, I'd be cutting a lot of slack to the committee to start pulling in all kinds of other departments here. And this is... No, that's quite all right. I just want, I want to speak particularly to the gentleman who asked the question. This is the Transportation Committee. We're dealing with DVS issues, and these things have been vetted in a couple of other committees with Secretary of State. So I'm reluctant to drag the Secretary of State back into this, and so I would like to ask not, unless you want to really insist, and I will hear your insistence. But let's try to keep it to Ms. McCormick and to the issues in front of us with DVS complying with the first 19 or 21 sections of the bill, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I definitely want to always respect the power of the chair and the way the chair wants to run this committee. So specifically to Ms. McCormick, I really do have a question, because if you look at page number four.
Page what?
Page four, sir.
Okay. Ms. McCormick?
4.28. Mm-hmm. And I think I want to highlight this difference in the requirement of must on page 6 and how the existing language that is so well outlined on 4.28, it says, quote, if the applicant does not have a Social Security number and is applying for a Minnesota identification card, instruction permit, yada, 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 that the applicant certifies that the applicant does not have a Social Security card. So there's some room when we think in terms of how a person might complete an application in order to get a driver's license. Now compare that to what's on page 6, which doesn't provide such flexibility because it says must. And I see that there is a distinctive difference there. And so, Ms. McCormick, am I correct in my analysis that on page 4, that if an applicant doesn't have a Social Security number, that there's an alternate or some flexibility that the department uses by which to still provide a person with a driver's license?
Ms. McCormick, then I'm going to ask Ms. Kiffmeyer to comment as well. But remind us of the Social Security law. Since my children were little, every citizen born in the United States, I believe, is issued a Social Security number, if I'm not mistaken. Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, you are correct that all people are issued a Social Security number, but if they weren't born in the United States, they may not have one, or they may not have there's different circumstances that come into play for us on a daily basis where we need variances. But then there is a certification that's required on that application stating that you don't have a Social Security number. And the purpose of that is for the federal child support enforcement purposes, so that then if for some reason it's found at a later date or time that someone is fraudulently stating they don't have a Social Security number because they don't want to have, you know, repercussions from their Social Security number, whatever the issue is, then that can be used as a basis for prosecuting that individual. So that's the reason that, and also we need it because of commercial driver's licensing and trying to ensure we only have one driver, one record throughout the United States, so that we can't have people that are applying for driver's licenses in various states and have driving records that wouldn't allow them to drive a commercial vehicle in another state.
I had an employee like that once, and there was a reason he had three driver's licenses. I applaud your efforts to winnow those folks out. Representative Kiffmeyer, would you like to comment to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It actually is a my understanding, because this is Section 17106, Subdivision 3, mm-hmm. Okay? But also, this is one other section of Subdivision 3. It's 3B, and a question would be for Ms. McCormick, actually, in a way. My assumption would have been that because this is in that part, that if the applicant does not have a Social Security number and is applying, that we may have missed a technical addition here, voter identification card in with this other series of identification cards, and if we simply inserted that, then those areas of the Social Security number would also apply. And it may be that it's just one of those where we need to include that.
And where would that be again?
That's on page 428, same section as Representative Champion was referring to. It says if the applicant does not have a Social Security number, it is applying for a Minnesota identification card, instruction permit, and so on, that they do not have a Social Security number, and then it kind of gives that. It's the same place where you also had the religious issue as well. And I think this may be one of those areas where the voter identification card needs to be inserted as well.
Should we have Representative Vogel offer that amendment right now?
Sure.
Representative Vogel. Mr. Burris, would you report that we would like to put that where? Right after ID card and before instruction permit?
Mr. Chair and members, if we could take a moment there. Section 6 actually already deals with the application for the voter identification card, and it lays out a separate set of criteria. So I would recommend putting the change into that section and modifying the requirements in there rather than
on line 4.28 or 29.
This would be on line 6.6 and 6.7. If I could take a minute, I could do up an amendment that would,
and Mr.
that would
Chair?
Do that.
Well, why not, Mr. Burris, why don't you do that then while Representative Champion asks his next question?
And, Mr. Chair, perhaps I think that it would be prudent for us to refer this bill to civil justice. And here's why. Civil law, I should say. I've just looked at some of the language in the bill, and I can see where it would be important for some other eyes to really vet some of these issues out. Make sure that they're asking even the author questions that perhaps she's already thought about, or at least she can explain to that group of people, and it would be important in that body's jurisdiction to handle these issues, because you've been so eloquent in making sure we're clear that we want to stick to what is in our jurisdiction. And so with that, I want to put forth a motion for this bill to be referred to civil law.
You want to do that out of this committee, or you want to do it on the floor?
Out of this committee.
Okay.
Sir.
Well, I'll entertain that motion in just a moment. In the meantime, do you have any further questions for the witness on this issue?
No.
Done?
I've
got Representative Vogel is on the list. He's been patiently waiting to question the witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. I guess the most pertinent one is dealing with the issue that's most recent is the Social Security number and card, stating that Ms. McCormick stated that if a person was not born in the United States, they would not have a Social Security card. Well, in that case, then they are not a citizen of the United States. My question is, when you become a citizen of the United States, do you not get a Social Security number? And you would have to have that number, is what we're stating here, in order to vote. Is that correct?
Representative Kipfer, are you aware of that, how the statute works when you take your citizenship test? Are you assigned a Social Security number at that time?
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, members, I do know that with adopted children, that once their adoption is finalized, they are given a Social Security number. So I would expect that certainly as a part of citizenship, but I do not have personal knowledge of exactly when or that process. There are legal residents of the United States that there are a variety of processes in that area that I do not have the detailed knowledge of that. But again, if they have a Social Security number, the requirement to give that number is still a part of the proposal. But again, their full legal name, their date of birth, sex, residence, address, and in accordance with if they have a Social Security number or do not have one, we're able to make a reference to that particular area. But again, they still have to be a citizen, and that is still a requirement in order to vote. So, Mr. Chairman, I think at that point they generally do have a Social Security number by that point of becoming a citizen. Usually they would want to seek it at that point because it's part of the benefit structure as well.
Representative Vogel, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then this is going back a ways, back to Representative Morrill's questions about questioning on students. And a statement was made, and I recall this from having moved many times in my life, that that you are required to get a new driver's license stating your new address within 30 days of moving. Now, my question is that overlooked for students, for college students, or are they, if they move to an off-campus housing for 9 months of that year, they are living there in that, whether what town or whatever community they're living in, are they not required to get a new address, change of address on their driver's license? Ms. McCormick is coming back, I see, so thank you.
We'll let Ms. McCormick answer that question.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, DVS director, for the driver's license purposes, it would be whatever is your permanent residence. So if you are still claiming that your parents' home would be your permanent residence, the concern we have is we need to be able to locate you if we have any citations, violations, anything that you need to be notified of, if there's a traffic violation of any kind. And so we want the address where we are sure that you will receive the mail. And so if you can still prove that you are spending a good share of your time at your parents' address, that wouldn't be considered violating that law. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Follow up. That's good. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chairman,
Deacon, Representative Kipmeyer.
I think that is true for the issues in regards to a driver's license or some of that sort of function. But remember, residency in this case has to do with voting. So you can't have more than one residence at a time. If indeed you are maintaining your residence at your home address as a college student, then that is the address by which you will be voting from because that is your residency. If you are instead changing your residency for voting purposes or claiming residence at a different address, then that requirement of updating your driver's license to that residence does make a difference. You can't have two residencies at one time for voting purposes.
Thank you. Representative Beacon, were you on the list of people to chat? Do you have a couple of brief questions, please?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kipfmeyer. I guess one of the concerns that I have, I represent a district that has a significant percentage of senior citizens, and I am somewhat concerned about the impact this may have on senior citizens, especially those living in nursing homes. A significant percentage of senior citizens don't have photo IDs, again, especially those that are living in the nursing homes. So, and this would require that they do go to one of the 139 locations, and in the rural areas, you're going to find that they're further and fewer, fewer and further between. So I have concerns about the burdens that will be imposed on them, as well as the cost of getting there, especially if we're talking about seniors who, you know, have significant health care needs, maybe on oxygen tanks, things like that, having to transport themselves to these locations. And if consideration has been given to these people and the burdens that would be imposed on them.
Representative Kiffmeyer, would you like to describe how DVS is going to accommodate that process?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a general rule, all the same issues that would apply to anybody in regards to their change of residence do apply to seniors. There's no change here in regards in my bill to those same requirements. However, the issue for you in regards to somebody being in a nursing home and changing their residence are already accommodated through the normal process, which is when you are over 65, which means a resident of a nursing home over age 65 becomes a resident of that nursing home. They usually vote through an absentee ballot, and their change of residence is noted on their voter registration application when they do the absentee ballot process for the first time at that nursing home. And most of the time, the nursing homes do the absentee voting process, by which the county already, normal process, sends out election judges to conduct that absentee voting process, to be there to give them assistance in marking the ballot should they need it. So those areas. But additionally of note, which is something that many of us found out through this process, that if you are over 65 and your address has not changed, which is also the case for many seniors, their address has not changed, they're often in a very stable situation, they don't have to renew their license or ID card after the age 65 unless they change their address. But for purposes of a voter registration, they change their address through a voter registration process. And it can be done through the change. They can go from a driver's license to a Minnesota ID card, or they can update their voter registration for the nursing home or an assisted living facility at that time. But if you are over the age of 65, you do not have to renew your license on the same schedule. But Ms. McCormick is here, and I sense that, again, it's my understanding, and I'm glad she's here to just clarify, because that's new information for me.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, DVS director. You do have to renew your driver's license every 4 years, no matter what your age is. If you have an ID card, once you're 65, you do not have to renew your ID card.
That's it.
So...
clear and simple. Thank you, Ms.
And Ms. Cormick.
Mr. Chair, I should say, unless for some reason you have a different address, but you don't have to, rehave your ID card reissued once you're 65.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman and members, I thought what was interesting, also maybe somewhat encouraging for seniors, if your photo does not change when you're over 65, and that is for a driver's license, you can keep that same photograph and be permanently 65, even though you renew. And they're also able to renew, since they are not updating their photograph, they're also able to do through the mail renewal if they're not changing their photograph.
I'm not sure if I'm looking forward to that or not, Mr. Meyer, but thank you for sharing that with me. Representative Beacon, follow up.
Well, and Mr. Chair, and just to, I guess, reiterate, again, if they do move to a nursing home or to assisted living, then they would be required to go to one of these locations in order to get a photo ID. Is that correct?
Ms. McCormick or Ms. Representative Kiffmeyer, either one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Egan, the one thing I do want to say is you still have to renew your driver's license and have your picture taken. If you're driving, what we're talking about is if you just have an ID card, mm-hmm. then you don't have to keep having your picture taken. You don't have to go back to go get an ID card if your address isn't changing. But if you are in a nursing home and you still want to have an ID card. There may be some variances that we may do on a very special case-by-case basis, but it would require notarization and witnesses and all sorts of things. It isn't a matter of practice that we do that, where we would allow you to not come into our facility. And certainly we wouldn't be able to, because it is a very manual process, it would not be something that we could do across the state for everyone that would fit into that category. So, but there are very, very special circumstances where a variance is allowed under certain conditions.
For a driver's license.
For an ID card, mm-hmm. or a driver's license, where the person would need that and there would be no way for them to get to our facility. We may do that, but it's very unusual.
Thank you. We'll hope that you can be flexible going forward. President Champion, you raised the Social Security issue. Would you like to move the HRD 3 amendment that you see in front of you there? To add Social Security number or?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Champion moves the HRD 3 amendment to fill in the blank where we had there with the Social Security question. Further discussion? Hearing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The HRD 3 amendment is adopted. Did you get that, Representative Burris? Or Mr. Burris? Mr. Burris, not Representative Burris.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Good, thank you. Let's see. Representative Nelson, do you have a couple brief comments before we move this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I had to step out of the room a little while ago because another committee's going on.
One I'm supposed to be in as well, Mr.
Chair. Yes, I understand. Ms. McCormick or Representative Kiffmeyer, how long does it take to get a voter ID card? I mean, compare that with how long does it take once I renew my driver's license to get the new one mailed back to me? I mean, are we going to be able to get this voter ID card when I go there, or am I going to have to wait for it to be mailed to me? And what are we looking, what kind of time frame are we looking for the voter ID card? Is that going to be quicker or slower?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, for one thing, just to let you know that in the language of this bill, that a receipt, in other words, in a case where you already have a driver's license but you are renewing it or for whatever reason, the original card with the, usually it's a clip corner, plus the receipt with your address on it will suffice, and that is usually immediate. Okay, so you don't have to wait for the new card to come through the mail in order to get that. If you are applying for the very first time, I will let Ms. McCormick address that situation.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for our current turnaround time for issuing a new driver's license or ID card is, I think, 13 days. And that includes, because we do have to mail it to the individual, because that's how we verify residency, to make sure that person is at that address. If they are not at that address, or if they use a post office box, then those licenses or cards are returned to our office. And the post office has been very cooperative, and that's basically to ensure that the person is who they say they are and live where they say they are. If it's a duplicate driver's license, those or ID card, those are received within 6 days. And we have an expedited service, but which wouldn't apply in this case, which can cost additional money if you need one in 2 to 3 days. But because our card vendor is located outside of the state of Minnesota, it would be at least 2 days for us to be able to produce the card and get it back, 2 to 3 days.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, you have another question?
So, Ms. McCormick, so you're looking for the, my take on what you answered, how you answered, is that you're looking at about the same time frame to get a voter ID card back from the vendor.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, yes, that would be true. Otherwise, we'd have to initiate an additional contract.
Okay, follow up.
Okay, so this is the dilemma I'm faced with. Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer. I sell my house, or I move. I have to move out of my apartment, and it's going to be 20 days before the election, so I'd be able to vote in my new residence. But I can't afford right now to go change my driver's license. Would I be able to apply for and get this voter ID card at my new address before the election? And would I be able to vote? Or would I be stopped from voting? Or would I have to go back and lie and with what my current my driver's license vote in my old residence? Where are we at on this situation? I mean, am I going to be able to get this voter ID card? I've got a driver's license, but I don't have the $6 or whatever it is right now to get this renewed. What am I going to be able to get this voter ID card?
Ms. McCormick or Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, first of all, if you already have a driver's license, you wouldn't be using a voter identification card. You would be using your driver's license, and what you're saying is that if a person is in the middle of moving, that they would still be required, if they have a driver's license, to renew that driver's license with a new address. But there is provision that if they're in the process of moving and that residency where they are living at that time, that they are able to vote from that residence. I mean, nobody's going to be turned away. If they want to, if they do have a defined address, a specific address, but they're moving but they haven't taken residence there, we always have those situations, and has been in the past, you've been able to vote from your original residence where you had been currently living at, which would fit with your current driver's license. Ms. McCormick may have other information.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr.
I guess
Nelson,
the thing is that I've got 30 days to change the address on my driver's license. The election is 20 days from now. I still have 11 days after that election to legally change my driver's license, and I'll be in compliance with the law. But I can't afford the money to go get this. The voter ID card is granted free of charge. So can I not have a driver's license and have a voter ID card? I guess that's the question I'm having. Or if I have a driver's license, am I precluded from getting a voter ID card?
Representative Kipmar.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, in this particular situation, are you precluded from that? Again, if I'm a person and I'm moving and I'm going to go vote, I would certainly want to have a driver's license renewal rather than a voter identification card. But, Mr. Chairman, I think that is the law and those are the requirements, and voting is a very important responsibility, and also the need for driving. So I think whether you're getting it a little bit earlier or a little bit later, I think that renewal would be certainly a part of a voter's intention to get that at any rate required by law, and then also be able to make the receipt for that part of their voting. Or they can use the old address.
Well, Mr. Chair, that what I'm hearing, and maybe I'm hearing it wrong, but what I'm saying here is I don't have the money to go renew my driver's license. After the election, it's going to be 11 more days or 10 more days that I can have this driver's license before I have to renew it by the current law. So if I'm too poor to do that, maybe I've lost my house, maybe I've been booted out of the apartment I'm at, and now I'm in another apartment that's cheaper, but I can't afford to come up with the scratch, the money to buy that, to get my driver's license renewed. And you won't allow me to apply for a voter ID card. Basically, I'm being disenfranchised because I'm poor.
Representative Kiffmeyer, is it possible Representative Nelson has actually found the one flaw in your bill, or is it actually possible that he could get a voter ID card if he's in that particular situation he has just described? I believe the answer is yes, he could get a voter ID card, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly correct.
Thank
I'm trying
you
to give you the
questions.
Options.
That's all I need you to say.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm going to ask Representative Ms. Zuers at this moment to go through the fiscal note that we've all been looking for so that we can move to a couple of motions on this bill in the remaining 4 minutes. Thank you for your questions, members. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kiffmeyer. Ms. Zuers.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to focus on the Public Safety Department's portion of the fiscal note, since the amendment that was adopted earlier changed the Secretary of State's and other portions of the fiscal note. So on page 23 of the fiscal note, the Public Safety Department For fiscal year 12, if you look just on the table on the first page, you'll see a $75,000 cost. That $75,000 is made up of a rulemaking cost of $30,000 for the department, as well as $45,000 for the card vendor. Moving on to fiscal year 13, the $709,000 is on page 23 of the bill. The bill authorizes $709,000 from the general fund, an appropriation for fiscal year 13 only. So that is that appropriation. Mm-hmm. And that money covers the $9.85 cost for the cards. For the first year, and the Department of Public Safety has estimated that 72,000 people would be using this the card that first year. Moving on to the $324,000 that in fiscal year 13 from the Special Revenue Fund. That is, there are two components of that making up the $324,000. The first is in the bill, there's a provision that reimburses the driver's license agents at $5 per application. And the driver's license agents process about 80% of the claims. So that adds up to about $288,000 for fiscal year 13. And then the second component of that is that there's a requirement to verify citizenship, and that is $36,000 of that $324,000. For fiscal years 14 and 15, the Department of Public Safety has estimated that in 14 and 15, each of those years and the out years, that there will be 15,000 applicants for the new card. And at the $9.85 per card that it costs to create them, that is about $148,000 per year to produce the cards. And then and that would come, since the appropriation from the general fund is a one-year appropriation, the department expects that the cost for producing the cards would come out of the special revenue fund. And then there's also included in that $215,000 the $5 reimbursement to the driver's license agents, as well as a cost for verifying citizenship.
Thank you for your explanation. Questions for Ms. Zewers? Seeing none, Mr. Bogle will renew his motion. Who has a question? Representative Hausman.
The question of tails?
Certainly. Make your question.
I'm assuming there would be, because this is an ongoing, this doesn't ever end. So there would be.
Ms. Sewers,
tails.
Can you speak to those?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, the costs that are noted in 14 and 15 on the table would be continuing costs. So $215,000 per fiscal year from the Special Revenue Fund.
On into the future.
Representative Hausman? Okay, thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Mr. Bogle will renew his motion that House filed to, just a moment, I'm coming to you, that House filed 210 be recommended to pass and referred to Ways and Means. Representative Champion has an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would like to renew my motion to refer House File 210 to civil law.
Okay, that would actually be an amendment to the motion. I think that's the proper way to handle this, if I'm not mistaken. So Representative Champion's motion is to amend the motion to refer the bill to civil law. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Nay. The motion does not prevail. The motion is not adopted. We're back to the original motion to refer this to Committee on Ways and Means. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed to Ways and Means. Members, we've got 30 minutes that we're supposed to be on the floor. I'd like to do Representative Benson's bill, which is very similar to this bill, but without as much money and without as much controversy, I believe. Representative Benson, would you like to move House File 89? And is it going to the Committee on Ways and Means as well?
Yes.
Would you like to sit up there for a moment? We'll do this in the saddle.
And Mr. Chair, as Representative Benson's walking there, I apologize
Certainly.
For interfering.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, as he knows, and I'm not saying that this takes precedence. We have caucus now. I know there are two of us who have bills that are we need to report on right now. It's unfortunate. I understand that you want to try to get things done, but please understand that this does go beyond the time that we had set.
It does. And we're going to come back here, members, at 1 o'clock and rug up a whole other string of bills, but we have testifiers that have come from all over the city to be here. So, Representative Benson, this bill moves to Ways and Means?
It does. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move. I have an amendment, the DE2 amendment.
Okay. And what does that do to the bill that's...
The DE2 amendment does some clarification to the bill, and that it now directs that the Department of Vehicle Services issue the photo identification card rather than the county auditor. This bill's been heard in both GovOps and GovFinance. It was passed out of those, and it was during that time that through discussion it was made apparent that in order to have the kind of protection of the cards in terms of security of the cards, that it needed to have the same level of integrity as driver's license, the hologram and the like. So what I've done is then incorporated the language that's been in 210 from the beginning in terms of who were to produce the cards, and now I've made that part of House File 89.
Mr. Benson, would it be fair to say that the Bleed All Amendment you have here and the discussion we've just had would be relevant and germane to everything that you're trying to do in the DE2 amendment?
It all is relevant. I only want to make one oral amendment to this, and it doesn't change the fiscal note, and that is on page 4, and it would be section 5, and we're looking at line 4.5, is to change that to, instead of $5, to $9.85. So it mirrors exactly the Kiffmeyer amount and the amount of that's been reported from DVS that it would be required in order to produce the card.
Mr. Burris, do you have that oral amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Can we just incorporate that as the authors, or do we need to vote on that?
Mr. Chair, that could be something the author incorporates into the delete all.
The author will incorporate that into the delete all. Further comments or questions on the delete all amendment, Representative Hausman?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just quickly trying to figure out why is it necessary to move two bills?
Mr. Benson, would you like to speak to that?
This is actually basically the body of this bill is the same bill that's been in the legislation. I think Representative Emmer presented the bill a couple of years ago, and it does not address nearly the amount of change that the Kiffmeyer bill does in terms of the voter book system and registration. This is simply a photo ID bill, and that section of her bill that accomplishes that. And then it adds or includes some new language in terms of defining not being able to vouch, but the same provisional balloting procedures are incorporated into DE2. In terms of answering your question, this doesn't go nearly as far, and this is simply a photo identification bill.
So this is sort of photo ID light.
Photo ID light.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
I don't know if Representative Eakin is still here. What I understood earlier from, I don't know if you were in the room when the woman from the League of Women Voters testified, my understanding is that this was the bill that there are only 14 places in the state.
And I need to go on a record.
Benson, hold on.
I'm sorry.
Let Representative Hausman finish, then I'm going to ask you to speak to that point.
Well, I'd be interested in...
Yes, because she did make that comment, Ms. Knuth, I believe. Can you address that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman. I will make sure that before, and put this on record now, that before we go to Ways and Means that I've crafted, I've talked with House Research about it already to make sure that the folks in the deputy registrars are included. It was never my intention to reduce the amount. And in fact, it was the county auditor would have been 87. My intention all along was to go to the 139.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Hausman.
I guess to my original question, I mean, if we're really moving two really different approaches, that's what I hear him say, to voter ID, wouldn't it have been more logical to have this be a portion of Representative Kiffmeyer's bill would have been deleted and this bill inserted if it's the intention of the committee to move this form through? I'm confused about moving two different approaches through.
Well, Representative Hausman, since I'm not on election law, I am on local or government operations and election law. We heard these originally. It struck me that they were different enough, and they've got different things going on. But when it comes to DVS, I think they're just pretty much identical to what DVS is going to be required to do to accomplish this, which is the interest in this committee. So they're going to do both those things. The DVS is going to react one way or the other, regardless of which bill finally becomes law, because I doubt both of them will become law, if either of them do. But the DVS will be doing exactly one or the other. It's the same, so I'm okay with that. So, Representative Benson, anything further to add?
It's not really. I think most of the questions were asked were many of the same questions they're asking the two preceding preceding committees. And in all intent, this is a photo ID bill. And in terms of DVS, it will be very similar, almost exactly, to what you saw in 210. I do need to make that one change, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll look forward to that in Ways and Means. Ms. McCormick, I'm going to look at you and say, do you feel compelled to counteract the testimony Mr. Benson's given that this is substantially different than the other bill as far as it impacts your audience? Thank you. And for the record, she said no, so I'm not going to ask her down to testify to this particular bill. Further questions or comments for Mr. Benson, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Benson. I guess with your amendment that you did for the changing the dollar amount from 5 to 985, is the fiscal note that we were handed out here, is that was that written, do you know, to the 985, or was that written to the $5 fee?
Representative Benson?
Yeah, both of those are actually included. It's separated out. The bottom line would need to be included so that it would have the $5, but those figures are in there. If you want, we can go through.
Could you briefly, Representative Benson, or do you want to have Ms. Zewers do it? Either way.
I think I can. On the very first page.
Now we're looking at the...
I'm sorry.
2A fiscal note?
2A fiscal note 4611. There are two areas there that would change. Their numbers are annotated but not included in the total. And that would, if you look
annotated
back.
Annotated where?
On that, look on page 10. That would be the best description.
There we go.
Under expenditure and revenue formulas. There is a difference of $36,000. In the narrative, it goes through that they're expecting to issue 36,000 cards the first year and 43,500 the second. So the numbers, $4.85, the difference between only... subsidizing to the cost of $5 rather than the full $985 would add an additional, they've rounded the numbers on the front to $175,000, mm-hmm. and then additional $211,000 the second year.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, does that mean it's the fiscal note is accurate for the way the amendment is, or does it add additional costs? And I guess that's...
Let's ask Ms. Zewers to speak to that. Ms. Zewers, can you speak to the question of Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the fiscal note was written for the DE2 amendment. So with this change, I would request a new fiscal note because the change would allow for the full $9.85 to be reimbursed, and the fiscal note is written where the driver services operating account would need to cover the difference between the two, which is $4.85.
So would approximately double the cost there. Approximately $9.45 more.
No, Ms. Zewers, would that mean that the impact of the state, the cost of the state would be greater than about twice, as Representative Nelson's indicated?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, no, it's that the cost would come from a different account. So there, it would be more of an accounting shift than it would be an increase in cost, because the cards themselves are $9.85. Representative Benson's DE2 amendment, when it was at $5, it was only covering a portion of the cost of the cards.
Okay. I think I understand that. Yes.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
The other question I have here is, being on the Government Operations Committee, what portions of the DE2 amendment have been changed that were not heard in government operations that would affect them there? And I guess the reason I'm asking that is because there's items in here that deal with government operations and elections, then we should probably see it there again in government operations. Because if those are significant changes, you know, this has gone through the process, and now I've got to delete all amendment here before we're sending it to Ways and Means, and then I'm assuming to the floor. Those are issues, that items that should have been taken care of in government operations.
Well,
Representative Benson, I'm going to ask you, you can respond to that and look at page 14.21 of your DE2 amendment. Tell me why there's a blank there. Maybe before you even respond. Just flip the DE2 amendment right over on its back.
So, Chairman, under appropriation?
Yes. 14.21.
I see it. Mr. Chairman, you're asking for the fill in the blank there?
At this late date, no. What I'm going to do now is
that's
lay
the difference.
This bill over. And we'll declare a recess until about 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Thank members, we're going to declare recess. 1 o'clock. Call the meeting back to order. I understand there is an amendment. Is that the A18 amendment? The A18, Representative Benson. Where's the motion work? Representative Benson, this is your bill. You've moved it. Would you like to move the A18 amendment?
I would.
Speak to it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A18 amendment. It makes a clarification on the question that came up in the previous time period.
Certainly. So, Representative Benson or Mrs. Zewers, this is to the DE2 amendment. Just a moment here. Yeah, this is to the DE2 amendment that we're working with. And just so members are clear, the chair is clear.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Biskins, can you help me think a little straighter about this?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just procedurally, I don't know if we've adopted the DE2 amendment yet. And if not, then the author of the bill could probably just incorporate this amendment.
I'm glad for every member on this committee, because you all contribute, but that is an outstanding reminder that we have yet to adopt the DE2 amendment. We've been discussing the DE2 amendment, members. So I will withdraw, Benson will withdraw his A18 motion, and we will go back to the DE2 amendment, which is before us. Further discussion of the DE2 amendment, bearing in mind there will be further discussion of the bill before we pass it. Seeing none, all in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Members, the DE2 amendment, the motion prevails, the DE2 amendment is adopted. The A18 amendment to the DE2 amendment now, as adopted. Representative Benson makes that motion. Questions to the A18 amendment? Comments to the A18 amendment? Ms. Zewers, I'm going to ask how this affects the fiscal note that we have in our packet. Does this comply with what you have given us there?
Mr. Chair and members, what this does is it does have an impact on the fiscal note. In the fiscal note on page 10 of 10, under the expenditure and revenue formula portion of the note, it talks about the state subsidized ID card expense in fiscal years 12 and 13, as well as an expense from the driver services operating account. What this does is it combines those two costs and makes the full cost from the state subsidized ID card, or from the new account, the state subsidized ID card account. So so the full cost of that, so the full $9.85 per card in fiscal year 2012 is $354,600, and then $428,475 in fiscal year 13. So the totals on the fiscal note don't change. And that those totals are reflected in the amendment. And then the other portion of the amendment, the changes on page 4 are make it so this money is actually appropriated to the Department of Public Safety. It's a statutory appropriation.
Thank you, Ms. Zuers. Question for Ms. Zuers? Seeing none, let's adopt the A18 amendment, Mayor, members, then we'll finish discussing the bill. As many as are in favor of the A18 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended. Members, Representative Nelson, you had the floor with a line of questions. If I could ask, we got folks have traveled a long ways to testify on some other bills. So if you could ask your questions and
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Accordingly, thank you.
And we were in the middle of getting the question answered that, and I restated about what portions of this DE2 amendment. Mm-hmm. We were going from 11, I believe it is, sections to 18 sections or 17 sections, 17 sections. What portions of the new DE2 amendment pertain to elections that were not heard in Government Operations and Elections Committee?
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson, actually, everything that has been changed in with the DE2 amendment has been vetted already as part of the language in 210. So if I've had incorporated language, it's language that has been vetted already in 210, and it was around just the two issues. One was vouching and making vouching more clear, and the second is where, in fact, the cards were going to be produced.
Representative Nelson, does that answer the question?
Sure. So we're going to take the testimony in that from 210, and we're going to incorporate it in this bill. I don't know if that's been done before, but okay, there's not much I can do about it. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Benson, Representative Benson, would you just succinctly tell the committee, once again, House File 89 is a portion of House File 210, which is we just recently passed to the Ways and Means Committee, correct?
A portion of it is the language that was in 210. We clarified the language on not allowing for vouching and used the language in 210. And we incorporated language out of 210 that directs vehicle services rather than the county auditor for producing the cards.
So, Mr. Representative Benson, then, the portions that pertain to DBS and the interests of this committee, are they generally the same as what we did in 210?
They are generally the same, aside from the fact that I will introduce language to make sure that the deputy registrars are included, mm-hmm. and I went on record to say that before it goes to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Further questions of the testifier? The motion is that House File 89, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Seeing no further questions, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed to Ways and Means. Members, this is one of those days when several of us have to be three places at once, and Mr. Murdoch is one of those. I'm one of those. Representative Nelson's one of those. I think most of us probably should raise your hand if you don't have to be two places at once. So what I'd like to do, though, is look at my testifiers for the Baird bill, House 1403. If I bring that up now, are you folks ready to testify to this bill now? Okay. Members, what I'd like to do is turn the gavel to Representative Biskins until Representative Murdoch gets back. And I will present House File 1403, and I'll make my motions from the front there. Representative Biskin.
Thank you.
Representative Beard, to your bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill to get in front of us, but I'd like the bill to be laid over, and I mean just laid over. Members, the Legislative Audit Commission several months ago now did a fantastic work, piece of work on governance of transit in the metro area, which raised several issues, some of which the folks that I represent in Scott County have been dealing with for some time. I think the auditor used the word dysfunctional. I don't know if I'd go that far, but certainly we sometimes seem like we're at cross purposes with transit governance and with the way we deal with transportation. Obviously, a few years ago when the legislature abolished the Regional Transit Board, there were issues that arose, and of course we had to create the Transportation Advisory Board to comply with federal law for receiving federal funds for a Metropolitan Planning Organization, because as it turns out, the Metropolitan Council, as it's constituted, does not comply with federal law for receiving funds, hence the TAB has been created. Members, House File 4203 is drafted and brought forward by my constituents and folks I represent in Scott County as a step forward in creating a transportation board, which basically synthesizes the functions of the Met Council transportation portion anyhow and the Transportation Advisory Board. And I will tell you that this bill, should it become law as it's written, has a fiscal note that is pretty significant. It's not to be, it's not a note that I've asked to be distributed to the committee yet, but until the note is in a fashion where it actually is a credible note that the committee could distribute or consider, I don't think it's fair to ask the bill to be moved along or included in any other portion of legislation at the moment. And hence my request to hear the bill, have my friends from Scott County testify, stand for questions, and then we'll lay the bill over until we can actually get our arms around the fiscal note that is one we can be reasonably assured of being accurate. So, if Mr. Chairman, with that, I've got two testifiers that would like to speak to House File 1403 before we stand for questions.
All right.
Okay, Commissioner. Mr. Chair, I'm John Ulrich, Scott County Commissioner. I've been a commissioner and a member of the TAB for 10 years. And I want to point out really two points in regard to this bill, or two reasons for the bill. One is, I would say the process with the TAB and the Met Council in the past many years has been cooperative and collegial and working together. I would say that over the last number of years, few years at least, the relationship is not as collegial and cooperative, and in fact, I would say it's fairly broken. The last transportation policy plan for the metro area, as a TAB member, I would say that there would have been three steps to the adoption of that plan. One would be a presentation of the TPP to the TAB, where they, in the fullness, tell us what is in the TPP. Then that TPP would go out for public comment, and the public would make whatever comments, and then they would come back, and those comments would be presented to the TAB. And then also in a third meeting, those responses that the Met Council would have, how they accommodated those comments, how they adjusted the TPP, that would be presented to the TAB. And then we would see the final TPP and give our advice, our advisory opinion on that, and make recommendations. In this last TPP, not one of those happened in the timely fashion that you would expect. Not while we were considering the TPP did any of those happen. It was never presented in fullness. We never saw the comments. We never saw the response to the comments. In fact, on the final day that we were asked to vote on it, I pointed out the frustration with not seeing the TPP. How could we consider to be advisory to the TAB without even seeing the TPP? And they said, well, if you want to see it, it's going to be published on Thursday night, which was the day after we were expected to vote on it. And then about a month later, they came back, and I think they were feeling, well, we kind of blew it. We'll have to cover our bases. And so the Met Council then did present a synopsis, sort of a redaction of what some of the comments were and some of their responses were, but that was after the fact. And so I would say the process is broken. There's been sort of an overreaching by the Met Council and excluding the elected officials and the advice of the TAB. Now, there's even some debate of right now under the current format whether the TAB should be advisory even under its current framework, because at times we're asked to vote to amend the TPP, take a formal vote to amend the TPP, and Vanessa on the tab go, well, how can you say we're strictly advisory on the transportation policy plan on one hand, and then on the other hand have us vote to amend, and our vote to amend is critical? It doesn't seem to make a consistent sense. So that's the one point, is that the process is flawed, but that isn't even the more structural or larger problem. The problem is that the arrangement that we have with the TAB and the membership, who's appointed, and how the TAB is structured, does not comply with federal law. It violates federal law. The people that are appointed, there's like eight appointees from the Met Council directly. Those are not allowed in federal law. They appoint the chair of the TAB. That's not specified in federal law or allowed in federal law. And then if everything was in compliance with federal law, the TAB would be the MPO, not the Met Council. So we believe that this bill is a correction to the in complying with federal law. So those are my two points that I'd like to make. And I'll turn it over to our administrator, Gary Shelton. He would like to also make some comments.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there any questions of Commissioner Ulrich at this point? Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Ulrich. Or Mr. Shelton, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Commissioner Ulrich covered most of the points that we were looking to cover.
Mr. Shelton, if you could just introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Yes, I'm Gary Shelton. I'm the county administrator for Scott County.
Thank you.
Been with the county for about 34 years. Commissioner Ulrich covered most of the points that we believe are relevant to this particular bill. Representative Beard talked about the creation of the TAB as being to comply with federal regulations. As Commissioner Ulrich testified, we don't believe in its current structure the TAB does. More importantly, we believe that the current process and approach to the TAB is one that's open to challenge and certainly confusing. And we believe that the legislation which is before you today not only clarifies the role of the TAB, but is a very reasonable and limited approach to resolving any lack of clarity as to the role of elected officials in both the policy and in the distribution of federal transportation dollars within this region. We would also point out that when you look at MPOs within the state of Minnesota, every MPO in the state, with the exception of the metropolitan, is in conformance, strict conformance, with federal law. So outstate Minnesota, the TAB would be the MPO in a similar fashion as to what we're proposing here. If you look at the entire country, you will not find a single MPO anywhere in the country that is created and is managed in the way the Metropolitan Council is. What we're simply asking with this legislation is that the MPO that deals with federal dollars within the metropolitan region be constituted in the exact same fashion that every other MPO in the state of Minnesota and in the United States is, and that it comply with federal law and recognize the importance that elected officials play in this particular process.
Thank you, Mr. Shelton. Is there any questions of Mr. Shelton? And I have a question. Commissioner Ulrich, do you know, has there been any challenge brought forward by anyone in the metropolitan area to our current structure? Has there been any court challenges that you're aware of?
No, there are no court challenges or formal challenges. I will just say, over many years, many of us on the TAB have questioned this issue. Mm-hmm. Other counties, other county commissioners, other elected officials have questioned the structure that we're under, but no formal challenges that I'm aware of.
Commissioner, one final question. Has there been any dialogue among any of the other six counties in forming together to support House File 1403?
I'm going to defer to our Administrator Shelton. He'd have more information on that.
Mr. Shelton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there has been discussion amongst other metropolitan counties. There's not, I think, a forward position that all of them would support, but in terms of this particular process, their role, the role of the TAB, that I'm aware of, all of the counties that we've spoken with, the counties within this region are generally supportive of making some change that allows local elected officials to play the role that the federal regulations would say is their role in this process.
Uh-huh.
I can make one, Mr. Chair, one final comment. I would say that the tab currently, looking back, was very uncomfortable with the process that was gone through to adopt the TPP. That's why they're currently evaluating all the source documents and evaluating the entire process as a tab right now. In fact, this Wednesday's meeting will be on that subject, and there'll be ongoing meetings on that subject because there was widespread, nearly unanimous discomfort with the process that occurred at the end of last year.
Seeing no questions, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. When the TPP was being promulgated by the Met Council, I think that was happening concurrently with the auditor's report on transit governance, which kind of gave rise to the, I guess, sort of the shakiness of the whole relationship between the seven counties, the Met Council, the TAB, and several other folks involved in transit and transportation governance. House File 1403, this bill is a starting point, at least for the folks in Scott County who felt probably the most blunt end of the club whenever it came to what we believe we saw in the TPP that was updated just at the close of last year. And so let this be a marker that we intend to have this discussion going forward. I'm sure there will be other legislation introduced. There may be other groups put together to talk about this whole governance of transportation planning and transit as we come into compliance. And I'd appreciate your attention to these matters as we move forward. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to have you lay the bill on the table.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Before I do, is there anyone in the audience who'd like to speak on this legislation? We have somebody, and while he's coming up, Representative Hausman, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have just wished that the author might have gone a little further. I looked here, and it looks like you didn't get rid of any bureaucracy. You just added more, and of course, I do believe it is an area where we have to do significantly more work, but the idea would be maybe less rather than more.
Thank you. Music to my ear, Representative. To the testifier, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ryan O'Connor from the Association of Minnesota Counties, and specifically to your question a second ago, Mr. Chair, about conversation amongst more than just Scott County in the room and the other six counties in the metropolitan area. Specifically, AMC District 10, comprised of the seven metropolitan area counties, did sit down starting last summer with Commissioner Ulrich and Commissioner Ulrich and Administrator Shelton at the table to have this conversation about how do we go about looking at metropolitan governance in the Twin Cities metropolitan region as it relates to transit and all the other things that are also involved in that larger question. We have some handouts on that that I will be happy to provide to the bill author as well that have been made public by AMC as the first step. But where all seven counties did come to an agreement is that when you start to ask specific questions, the fundamental question of governance, becomes the most core question to the entire discussion. And I believe the auditor's report, specifically related to transit, made very similar agreement in that area. We would argue that it goes beyond transit to a bigger discussion, as been indicated today. But for the record, we wanted to let you know that all seven counties in the metropolitan area have come to an agreement that governance is where we believe the question really needs to start and be answered. We're happy to work throughout the interim to continue discussing this question with the bill author and any other legislators as well, and we do appreciate attention to this issue as it's a very important issue to address. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Is there any questions by members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Yes, we have a representative of the Metropolitan Council who'd like to weigh in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the bill. I have to apologize. I was over in the Senate when the testimony began on this bill because we're working on the same bill over in the Senate. But I'll be short and sweet. I did catch Chairman Beard's comments about wanting to lay the bill over and letting this be a starting point for conversation. And I do understand that there was some frustration with how the transportation policy plan worked its way through the process last year. The council believes that we followed the appropriate manner and adopted that plan, although I do recognize the fact that Scott County and Commissioner Ulrich were upset with part of that process. And if it's Chairman Beard's intention to have this be a conversation starter and a starting point, we'd be happy to do that. And
I know I've communicated that to him, and I communicated that to Commissioner Ulrich this morning, and we can leave it at that if that's the intention of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Shetton. And Mr. Shetton, any specific comments as to statements made earlier that the current structure of our MPO may be illegal by federal law?
Mr. Chair and members, actually, I don't believe that that is the case. We have a letter dated January 13th of 2011 from the Federal Highway Administration that basically states that the FHWA consultant with their Office of Chief Counsel and their headquarters planning staff to ensure that they thoroughly vetted the issue before reading a determination. And it says the FHWA has concluded that the 1973 designation as of the Met Council as the MPO for the Twin Cities by then Governor Anderson was in conformance with both the law and regulations, and that the existing structure remains in compliance. And that was done January 13th of this year.
And but Mr. Shetton, and I trust that that document is in the hands of the author.
Mr. Chair and members, the document was actually sent to Scott County, and the council was CC'd. I actually was given a copy of this morning. It was sent to the chair of the council, Commissioner Sorrell, Arlene McCarthy of the Met Council, Ron Moses of FHWA, Susan Moe of FHWA, and then the Scott County attorney. And I'm happy to hand a copy to Representative Beard if he does not have that yet. But as I mentioned before, Mr. Chair and members, again, the council believes that the structure was appropriate. But what we are saying is, and that we have committed to in a letter that was also sent to Scott County by then Met Council Chair Peter Bell, that the council is happy to work with the counties and TAB moving forward in order to address how TAB works with our transportation policy plans and policy plan updates. So I would like to leave it on that note, that I think that we can look at this cooperatively moving forward.
Do appreciate that, Mr. Shetton and Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated the county's testimony, and I just hope that somewhere somebody grabs a hold of it and provides leadership in the interim. Otherwise, next year we'll be back here again acknowledging governance is broken, but with nobody having any sense of consensus around a new model. And somewhere, I mean, that obviously if the leadership could come from the counties, that would be, seem to me, a logical place.
Well, thank you, Representative Hausman. And I do believe the chair of this committee has mentioned this on a couple of occasions, that the governance of the metropolitan area, particularly around transit and transportation issues, was going to be a priority over the interim. But Representative Beard, do you want to speak to that specifically?
Well, it's one of the reasons, Mr. Chairman, that we launched House Bill 1403 to kind of be the first out of the starting gate. I'm sure there will be other wisdom contributed to the discussion, and yeah, we'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shetton. Do we have any other testifiers? Yes, sir. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
My name is Peter Hansen Reyes, purveyor of 6 privately held corporations in the state of Minnesota, one involving the glass bowl for the Vikings. I am a entomologist, E-T-Y, M-O-L-O-G-I-S-T. I wonder how this plays in duplication of efforts with the Metropolitan Council Department of Transportation, as all the Metropolitan Council is appointed by the governor. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you. Any questions of the testifier? Seeing none, any further comments from members of the committee? Representative Beard? All right. With that, the chair will lay over House File 1403.
Thank you, members.
Representative Fortman, if you'll come to the table.
Mr. Chair.
Do we have somebody in the committee who'd like to move House File 1214?
Well, I'll move House File 1214, and where does it need to go?
Representative Nelson, I believe we're going to lay it over for possible inclusion.
I'll move House File 1214 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Policy Bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Fortman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to see you here in the Transportation Committee. It's too bad we didn't overlap. The bill I have today is a technical correction to the Child Passenger Restraint Statute. We passed that. It became effective in 2009. And then we did an amendment to exempt school buses in 2010. But the language that we chose to use in 2010 made us ineligible for the federal grant of $378,000. And so what we would like to do is fix the language, and what it does is make us eligible to receive that federal funding.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. You have a testifier with you?
I do, Mr. Chair. I have Cherie Marty from the Office of Traffic Safety at the Department of Public Safety.
Ms. Marty, welcome. Please state your name for the record and provide us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Cherie Marty. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And simply put, this particular bill only clarifies our existing language around booster. It does not change the intent of the law. It simply just makes us eligible for federal funding.
Okay. Members of the committee, any questions of Ms. Marty? Well, thank you, Ms. Marty. Representative Fortman, I also have on the list a Ms. Heather Darby. Do you know if she is here to testify?
She is here, Mr. Chair, but she's available to answer any questions that committee members might have. We know you still have a lot of bills to hear.
Okay. Is there any questions of either the author or the department? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who'd like to speak in favor or against the legislation? Does that mean you're heading to the restroom, Mr. Lundell, or you want to speak? Got it. Welcome, Mr. Lundell. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Brad Lundell with the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation, and I've missed you in education, so I'm
thank you.
I'm glad I could make the trip over here. We have no official position on the bill. We've worked very, very hard on the whole booster seat issue over the last few years, and we just want to make sure as we move forward that a lot of the progress we made in this area is not going to be in jeopardy, and we hope that, you know, I've worked with the author, worked with DPS, and I think that we're just hopeful that this can, for once and for all, you know, clear the fog on this issue. So,
Mr. Lundell, the language as it currently sits, do you see any added costs to our public school transportation system?
Mr. Chair, I can't say yes and I can't say no. I would think that when booster seats were, there was a year there when many districts had to go buy booster seats, but those seats have already been purchased.
Okay. And so, Mr. Lundell, you don't see this, in first glance anyway, as adding costs, but is it your intention to continue to look this over and provide the author of the bill, if there is concerns, prior to us marking up an omnibus policy bill?
Mr. Chair, we will certainly do that.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Any questions of Mr. Lundell from the committee? Thank you. Seeing no further questions or comments, Representative Portman, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was nice to be here today.
Thank you. I just got whispered in my ear, Representative Portman, that the Committee on Public Safety may want to hear this bill. Have you heard anything along that line?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that when we did this in 2008 that we did not go to public safety, and I think it's because of how the budgets are divided up amongst the committees, and I think our wonderful fiscal staff could help us if I'm wrong, but I think the portion of the Department of Public Safety's budget that would receive the money is in this committee's jurisdiction.
Okay. Well, Representative Hortman, again, I'm getting whispered in my ear that Chair Cornish has requested this bill. So I think at this time what we will do is Representative Nelson amends his motion. That'll save us time. I mean, if we just wait over here, have to come back and bring it up again, you know. But we'll also, at this point, I'll make a an in absentia decision for the chair of this committee that will also reserve the right to put this language in the omnibus transportation policy bill, even though we will amend the language to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Public Safety. So Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I will move that House File 1214 be passed and re-referred to public safety and be the option of including it in the omnibus bill be retained also.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Nelson. I think we'll just stick to the abbreviated motion that it be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Portman. Here. Representative Szymanski, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Members, we'll go to item number 10 on our agenda. Lay it over. Representative Szymanski, would you move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that House File number
1310
be approved for consideration and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Szymanski moves House File 1310 be before the committee. Representative Szymanski, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 1310 is brought to us by the Department of Transportation, taking care of a little bit of obsolete language and then also working toward streamlining the permitting process for oversized loads, overweight loads, and addresses some of the issues of heavier trucks. At this time, I'd like to defer to Mr. Eric Rudine from MnDOT to further explain the bill.
Thank you, Representative Mr. Rudine. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. Section 1 of the bill just allows a permit to be displayed electronically rather than having to carry a paper copy of a permit. Section 2 of the bill creates a new annual permit for trucks between 145,000 and 155,000 pounds. These trucks today are eligible for a single trip permit, but we've had a request for convenience sake from some folks who would like to obtain an annual permit. So they'll still have the option to get a single trip permit if they want, but they'll also have the option for an annual permit. Section 3 of the bill corrects something that was passed by the legislature in 2009, and this is for people who get a medical waiver to be able to obtain a commercial driver's license. If they've been suspended or revoked, they're not eligible for a medical waiver for 3 years. And in 2009, the legislature determined that only if you were suspended or revoked for a driving-related offense should you not be eligible for that waiver. If it was a non-driving offense you were suspended or revoked for, you would still be eligible to get that medical waiver. And so this Section 3 of the bill just corrects what was enacted in 2009 to go with the original legislative intent of what was enacted in that year. But we've had a case that went before an administrative law judge where he interpreted the statute what we think was incorrectly and inconsistent with the legislative intent from 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Rudine. Mr. Rudine, quick question. Is this legislation a product of Representative Szymanski's brilliance, which it is an abundance of, or is this an agency initiative?
Mr. Chair, this is an agency bill.
Thank you, Mr. Rudine. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see there's a fiscal note attached to this, and there's a note that was passed that the fiscal note's being revised and be resubmitted. Is there going to be a fiscal impact on our current budget up with this, and is it included are taken care of in the budget for this committee going forward.
Representative Szymanski, would you like to explain the fiscal note, or should I ask Mr. Rudin?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to Mr. Rudin.
Thank you. Mr. Rudin, to the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, there will probably be fewer of the single-trip permits purchased, but then those permits, people purchasing those permits today would purchase the annual permit. And, of course, these are just estimates. We never know how many permits will be purchased until somebody comes forward to actually buy the permits. I don't know if Ms. Sewers has anything to add.
Thank you, Mr. Rudin. Ms. Sewers, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair and members, I actually do.
Wonderful.
On the fiscal note, on the front page of the table, you'll notice that that the $5,000 is coded under the expenditures section of the note. It should actually be coded under the revenues. And there's a $5,000 per year in additional revenues that will be generated for the state. The narrative on page 2 is correct. It's just that it was coded wrong in the system. So I believe that MnDOT is updating the note.
All right. So, Ms. Sewers, I believe that then what we're actually looking at is revenue coming into the state of $5,000, not a cost to the state of $5,000 a year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct.
Representative Nelson, any comment to that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. But I do have another question.
Representative Nelson.
Just wanted to verify, I'm looking at the bill, and I don't see any changes. We're not changing any weight limits of overweight trucks. We're not doing any of that. This is just technical cleanup language.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, we're not changing weights of trucks because, as I said, these trucks today can buy a single trip permit. And this just makes them eligible for an annual permit.
That's what I wanted to hear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any comments, questions, testimony from the audience? Any further questions, members of the committee? Representative Szymanski, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just renew my motion that this bill be laid over for further inclusion.
All right. With that, the chair will lay over House File 1310. Representative Cornish, welcome to the committee. You're up. You're not up.
Representative Deere told you weren't going to hear it, so I sent the testifiers home.
Okay. Members.
Until next after break.
Members, please scratch item number 8 from your agenda. Let's see, what do we have next? Smith, Banyan, or Biskins? Well, I can do it.
Anything else?
Okay, Representative Biskins, your House File 1378.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1378 be before the committee.
And what are we going to do with it? Lay it over, or vote on it, or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. I would ask the committee administrator if the chair of the committee has expressed any consideration. Otherwise, I'd like to move that it be passed and be referred to the general register.
Okay, then we'll, Chair will move that House File 1378 be approved and sent on to the General Register. So to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As we look at reinventing government, looking at doing things in different ways and providing flexibility for moving forward with government as we know it, this legislation matches that philosophy, albeit in a very, very, very tightly controlled realm. What this legislation simply does is it MnDOT seeks the ability to look at alternative ways of financing projects. To give you an example, let's say on Highway 199, you have a township that is looking at putting a an expanded crossing across that highway, and they've been working with MnDOT, and MnDOT says, you know, that is on our 2018 project list, and the township says, well, you know, we've got the money right now, we'd like to work with you and maybe front end these funds and come up with a contractual arrangement so that when MnDOT does indeed have the money, you know, they'll pay us back, but we can get this work done in expedited fashion. This bill would allow that to take place. It's my understanding that that's what this bill would allow it to do. And Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Peterson from the Department of Transportation.
Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and tell us your story.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And I'd like to thank Representative Biskins for bringing this bill before the committee. As he stated, this bill is really relatively simple. It provides the commissioner with the authority to enter into a financing agreement with a governmental, non-private, or nonprofit entity in order to finance a transportation improvement. And this provision was part of a bill that was carried by Representative Beard last year. It cleared the Transportation Committee and ran into some difficulty in the Finance Committee, and that's why we are back here with this portion of that bill again this year. And part of the concern at that time, just for the committee's full awareness, was some concern about how would this authority to borrow money in particular fit within the existing financing and accounting systems that are currently used to manage the state's finances. And so the terms of the bill were modified to limit it to one pilot project so we could demonstrate our ability to manage this program effectively in the current environment. And another question that frequently comes up about this is, will this delay or defer projects that are already in the program? And again, the program is basically our four-year capital investment program that we have for the state all the time. And a lot of project proponents wait a long time for their project to rise to the top of that list, and we want to assure everyone that this will in no way cause a delay in anyone's project. We see it as an opportunity to actually bring more resources into the arena to finance more transportation improvements, and that is our intent with this bill. We see this, the primary benefit of this authority would be to act more quickly, be responsive to economic development opportunities that may arise across the state where an associated transportation investment is necessary to take advantage of the of those opportunities. And so we don't know in particular what form these opportunities might arise, but we think if the this authority is on the books, that we will start to see these proposals for this type of arrangement start to surface.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Radin, and Representative Biskins. The question I have, and you touched on it a little bit, and we talked about this in my office a couple of days ago, and I guess maybe I'm overly sensitive because the project in my area got the money stripped from it to do another big project in the metro area, and then when money was returned to the, when there was enough money to do this project, we were going to be dropped off the list, and that project wasn't going to get done. Fortunately, the money was restored, and the project is going forward and should be completed this summer. But there's some sensitivity in my part, I guess, that we're not going to be displacing projects, taking money from projects that are at the top of the list and have spent their years on the list and working their way up. And now that the highest bidder comes forward and says, we got money here to do this project, let's move our project up to the top, are we going to be taking money, MnDOT money, off of the current projects to do these projects that have alternative funding? And I know it's only one currently, but or are we going to, similar to other things that have done MnDOT, though they won't be paid back, the MnDOT portion, till their term comes up on the list?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, yes, the way the repayment will be handled is when a typical way in which repayment will be handled is when we have an opportunity to invest, let's say, in an improvement at an intersection, as Representative Biskins referenced, and for the MnDOT, in terms of the transportation needs in the state, the priority for that intersection is below some of the opportunities that are already on the program and scheduled as a higher priority. We would take advantage of this one to this provision to build that project earlier and then repay the funds that were provided for the project when that project's originally scheduled construction date appears in our program, so the financing would not interfere with any currently scheduled program, would not displace any project above it in the program, so those would all proceed on schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, any other questions for them? Anybody in the audience care to testify for or against the bill? Chair has one question. Representative Biskins, is this bill the result of your vast experience here in the legislature, or is it an agency bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd love to say I thunk this one up by myself, but this is an agency bill, and for the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is not a secret attempt to fund any rail projects in the Rochester area, and I've been assured that MnDOT is looking, wants the flexibility to keep this open for potential projects, but does definitely respect the fact that their bread and butter is our roads and bridges, and so looking at using this pilot for that is their desire. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1378 be passed and moved to the General Register.
Members, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
Passed and on the way to the General Register. He didn't want to. Okay, next we have Representative Banyan, House File 1367. Representative Banyan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. As I'm not a member of your committee, I don't have I assume one of you has the motion to move the bill. There is an amendment.
Okay. House File 1367. Is it been recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion? So,
Mr. Chairman, I'll move.
Okay. Representative Benson moves the motion.
Very good. And there should be an amendment in your packets. I'd ask you to look at as well. Thank you, Mr. It's the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment just asks that this bill pertains to bikeways, and this asks that the Mississippi River Bikeway, which is to be designated in this bill, that any other bikeways that are nearby it would be added to it. We've discussed it with the Department of Transportation. I don't think they have any problems with it as well. And I would ask someone to move that so that we could get it in the shape I'd like it.
I'll move the amendment too.
Representative Benson moves the A1 amendment. Members, any questions or discussion for the amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is brought to you on behalf of, by me, it was brought to me on behalf of the Department of Transportation. Mr. Rudin is here to testify to it, and I think I'll let him deal with his specialization, and I'll listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. Section 1 establishes the Mississippi River Bike Trail. You should have a handout on the back showing a map of that trail. It's part of a 10-state effort to establish a bikeway all the way from Lake Itasca to the Gulf of Mexico. Large portions of the trail are on local roadways. About 25% of it is on state highways. And then there are some sections where it will actually be on a separated trail. Section 2 of the bill just makes a technical correction to a designation of Trunk Highway 200, which last session was named the Veterans Memorial Highway. There was just a drafting error in that provision. Section 3 of the bill deals with a flashing yellow arrow, and you should have a handout on that as well. There's been some federal research that shows these are safer than making a left turn on a green light, and so as we install new signal systems or replace existing ones, we'll be using more of these flashing yellow arrows, and it sort of makes sense intuitively. When people see green, they think they can go and they have the right of way, but that's not always the case when you're making a left-hand turn. So it's been shown that this flashing yellow arrow hopefully will be a little bit safer, potentially we might use it in more applications, so that rather than having to sit at a red arrow for an entire cycle, you might be able to make your left turn more quickly. And then Section 4 of the bill also deals with that flashing yellow arrow. The rest of the bill, Sections 5, 6, 7, and 8, deal with a change at the federal level. There was a Federal Rail Service Continuation Program. That program was repealed a couple of years ago, and so instead of referring to that program, we would just refer to funds available from the federal government. And these sections of statute refer to the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, which is the freight rail assistance program for what we call short line or regional railroads, not the large class one railroads, but the very small local freight rail roads. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rudin, on the flashing signal, is that permissive language, or will that be mandatory? Would there be a fiscal note attached to that?
Mr. Rudin. Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski, it's not mandatory. From MnDOT's perspective, as we install new signals or replace existing signals, we would look at installing these. This option would be available for local governments, but it certainly doesn't mandate them to install them.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I have, as far as the education on the flashing yellow, is that going to be put into driver's ed? How are we going to be educated? Those of us who don't go back to driver's ed anymore, I hope, but how are we going to learn about that yellow, flashing yellow light?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, I think the department will try, as we use these more, to do some public education. For example, we recently are increasing the number of roundabouts that we have installed, and so we've put on the back of the state highway map some instructions about using a roundabout. We've used our booth at the state fair to try to inform the public about roundabouts, and I think this would be a similar situation. We also, in some instances, might put up a sign at the traffic signal itself, which says left turn must yield on flashing yellow. And hopefully as they become more common, people will understand how to use them. But we've had them installed in a couple places already, and our observations have been that people just sort of intuitively understand, that when they see that, they can make a turn, but that they have to yield to oncoming traffic.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that got into my question I was going to ask is, without this legislation, can you install these flashing yellow arrows? Because I've seen one. There's an intersection I frequent that I've seen it in a new highway, a new intersection there, and it does seem to work real well. The other comment I have is I wish this would have been done many years ago when I got my first ticket for going through one that in the middle of the night wouldn't turn over. So maybe we can go retroactive and go back and get that ticket taken off my license.
We'd all love that, wouldn't we? Members, any other questions? Anybody in the audience care to testify for or against? Seeing none, then Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 1367, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, Representative Smith. Good afternoon, Representative. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. House File 1109 needs a motion.
And we need a motion to move House File 1109 to the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1109 that would be recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Representative Szymanski.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 1109 is a technical cleanup bill requested by the Department of Public Safety. Last year, the legislature passed, and I think with almost unanimously, except for one vote, and the governor signed a major and comprehensive law to combat drunk driving and the epidemic of unlicensed drivers in Minnesota. Under this law that was passed, Minnesota's driver's license revocation periods were lengthened, but offenders desiring to follow the rules could be legally licensed almost immediately, provided that they agree to have an ignition interlock device installed in their vehicle. By expanding the interlock program, as many states have done, the offender then can get back on the road sooner with a legal license. The public is safeguarded because the interlock prevents the car from starting if the driver has been drinking, and the courts are no longer flooded with driving after suspension citations. The 2010 law is complex. It was given an effective date of July 1 of this year to allow time for rulemaking and other implementation steps, and this is why we're back here with this request. I'm going to introduce to you Ms. Joan Kupczynski of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division of Public Safety to answer any questions.
Ms. Kupczynski, I'm glad Mr. Representative Smith said your name first. Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself or identify yourself.
Joan Kupczynski, Driver Services Director, Department of Public Safety.
Members, any questions? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Kupczynski?
Correct.
Did I get that right? Okay, I practice that a little more than other folks around here. Page 1, line 123 to 125, talks about the alcohol concentration of twice the legal limit. What do we have currently in this law?
Currently it lists anything between 0.08 and 0.20, I believe. I'm sorry. Can you ask me your question
sure,
again?
I
apologize.
In the bill, in the new language, it refers to twice the legal limit, and I was just asking if the existing law had a different limit in it at that point.
Ms. Kupczynski.
Mr. Chair Member, no, it does not. It's not different.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Yes, Ms. Kupczynski. I'd ask. Does this make a difference? I mean, how does this improve this legislation?
Mr. Chair, member, what the new language will allow is that any individual currently under the current statute could have their revocation time reduced from 1 year to 30 days. And by making the change that the department is requesting, it would cause the revocation period to last for a year.
Members, any other questions? Seeing none, could I ask for the audience? Anyone in the audience? I can't remember if I asked to come down and testify for or against. Seeing none, Representative Szymanski renews his motion that House File 1109 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Policy and Finance. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Bill's passed.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your time.
Okay, Representative Nelson, a quick one and we're out of here.
So you don't want me to talk so
much. Well, you might be out of order if you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move House File 1067 to pass. Or is it going to be possible inclusion? For possible inclusion?
That'd be correct.
Yeah, I'll move House File 1067 to be for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And it's an agency bill, and I will let Mr. Radin here from the agency explain it.
So we don't have to ask you if it's an agency bill or not, if it's
yeah,
your,
okay,
all right. Yeah. Mr. Radin, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Radin, MnDOT Government Affairs. To just begin with a little background, Railbank property is property that MnDOT has purchased from railroads when they've abandoned a rail line. And you should have a map here of current Railbank property in the state of Minnesota. One of them we were just talking about with Representative Banyan's bill that has the Lake Wobegon Trail on it, which then extends up to Fergus Falls as part of the Central Lakes Trail. The other one is between International Falls and Bemidji, the Blue Ox Trail. We've had some instances that you can see by the photographs here of people actually logging state railbank property and using it for personal purposes. We've had farmers who have actually planted crops on railbank property, and so we're just looking to clarify the law to help us preserve and protect these corridors. These are corridors that by law we're supposed to preserve for future transportation or utility purposes.
That's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. Members, any questions for Representative Nelson or Mr. Radin? Anybody in the audience care to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Nelson moves that House File 1067 be laid over for possible inclusion in the transportation policy bill. With that, that's a wrap. Members, have a nice Easter. Everybody in the audience, have a nice and blessed Easter, and we'll see you after the break. Oh, forgot to gavel us. We're adjourned.